space, well, then y'all won't think this is hard either, because this is very similar to hemodynamics, and hemodynamics are going to come back to haunt you in this lecture a little bit. But it's like the air version of hemodynamics, because we're going to talk about some numbers and pressures and all of that kind of stuff. So the other part about vents that's very similar to hemodynamics is that although you can see a ventilator, if you have a patient that has a vent, there's a lot of stuff going on with that patient and that vent that you can't really see. And so it's very abstract, some of the concepts that we talk about. So this is some pretty deep stuff. I've taught hypertensive crisis. It's way easy. Don't stress about that. DKA is not hard, but the pathophysiology of DKA, most of you don't remember what that is by the time you get to fourth level. So I'm sure she's going to review that with you, because the treatment of DKA is so much easier to understand if you understand what's happening pathophysiologically inside the patient. So those are going to be much easier lectures than this. I don't think they like me. They give me all the hard stuff. I apologize. But we're going to talk about ventilated patients. And I will tell you, in most hospitals, the ventilator kind of belongs to respiratory therapy. We have respiratory therapists that are on the unit all the time. But if you're going to be a good nurse, then even though you may not be responsible for a piece of equipment, you need to understand how that piece of equipment is affecting your patient, because the nurse is responsible for the whole patient. And so you do need to understand some things. And there are some things that you're going to do with the ventilator based on what your hospital allows, wherever you're doing clinical or where you go to work. And so you need to have an understanding, maybe not to the level that the respiratory therapists have, but you certainly need to have a basic understanding of vents. So first we're going to talk about artificial airways. We have oropharyngeal, nasopharyngeal, ET tubes. We're going to talk about the process of intubation, and then trachs. Y'all seen trachs. Those are not just in ICU. We have patients with trachs that are at home walking around at Walmart filling the tomatoes on the med-surg floor. They come in for other things, and so you've dealt with trachs before. I know y'all learned how to do trach care probably in second level, so when y'all did that. These are the same trachs those are. It's just a little reminder. So we're going to talk about each one of those. Endotracheal tubes are most common for short-term airway management. An ET tube, similar to when we talked about a pacemaker, is used for short-term, not long-term. We're not sending people home with an ET tube. They are in ICU. We can do a oral or a nasal intubation with an ET tube. If it's a nasal intubation, they either had a very difficult airway, there was no way they could get it in orally because of anatomy, if they have a fixated spine because of previous surgery, sometimes they can't get their head tilted in order to be able to go in orally, or they're doing some sort of surgery, so they're avoiding that area, or maybe it's a trauma patient, and so they're bypassing the mouth because maybe they've had a wreck and all of this is crushed and bloody, or a gunshot wound, and you can't even tell where their mouth is, and so they'll go in the nose because it's easier to find landmarks that way. But by far, the most common is an orotracheal intubation. We use it to keep airways patent, so it's not just about people's oxygenation. So think about the patient who is internally, I forgot the word suddenly, decapitated, thank you, I was like this, internally this. Internally decapitated, if they don't have the nervous tissue intact between their brain and their diaphragm to tell them to breathe, then it may actually be a neurological issue rather than a respiratory issue. If we have a patient who has overdosed on some sedative or comes in very, very drunk, we may intubate them not because they can't oxygenate effectively, but maybe they're not awake enough to hold their airway open, or maybe it's someone that's had a stroke or a head trauma. So there's lots of reasons why we intubate people. It's not always respiratory reasons. It also helps protect them from aspiration. If we know their neurological status is blunted, then they're not going to have those protective mechanisms in place. So the way the ET tube is built, and we're going to look at that in a minute, the balloon that's on the ET tube should prevent them from aspirating. There are some things you're going to do to try to keep that from happening. We can provide positive pressure ventilation with an ET tube because it does seal off in the trachea. She's got candy up front. If y'all want candy, y'all will not bother me if you want to come get some candy. But we can give them positive pressure ventilation because it creates a closed system within the respiratory system. We can facilitate pulmonary toileting, and by that we mean we can say cough, 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 and they can cough, but we also can go down with a suction catheter and suction secretions out if they're unable to do so. And we have patients sometimes that are breathing just fine, oxygenating just fine, but they can't handle their secretions. And you'll hear the nurses say, I don't think they're going to extubate because he can't handle his own secretions. And what they mean by that is if it's a ventilated patient, the person's not coughing up and up to the end of the tube. They're still having to go down in and suction secretions out pretty frequently. And if we can't do that, then we know the patient's going to wind up in respiratory distress if we pull that access out. And then we can provide high oxygen concentrations. With an ET tube is the closest way we can give 100% FiO2. Now, we will say that we have patients on 100% non-rebreather, but we know that we're not really giving 100%. We're giving as close to it as we can. But with an ET tube or a trach, we can truly give 100% FiO2. So this is a picture of an endotracheal tube. They come in different sizes. You can see that this is a 7.5. Adult tubes typically have a cuff on them. I will tell you that pediatric tubes do not. Or the smaller they get, they may not. The reason being is because if you see a 1 ET tube, it's so tiny, the airways they're putting that little bitty tube in aren't much bigger than that tube, so there's not room to have a cuff on it. Now, if you don't have this cuff in place, then you know that it's easier for the tube to be pulled out because nothing's holding it in place, so they have to be very careful with those little bitty people that are too small for me to take care of to keep them from extubating themselves accidentally. But you also have a higher risk of aspirating depending on how big the airway is in relationship to the size of the tube because there's nothing to block that. So how this looks in a patient, you have this endotracheal tube. It has the sizes here. It has the depth here. So you can read that this is 18, 20, 22, 24, 26 centimeters. And what that's measuring is the distance from this tip all the way up to where the lines are. That's important because once they intubate a patient, we can tell how deep it is. So you'll hear them say a 7.0 ET tube, 22 is a lift. And what they mean is they've used a 7.0, that size ET tube, to intubate. And once they got it in place and they made sure it's in the right place, that it's taped with 22 centimeters at the lip. NCLEX loves to ask, if there's going to be a ventilator question on NCLEX, what it's probably going to be is some patient that's been moved for some reason. You've moved them to a different level of care, you've put them on a specialty bed, you went to CT, there's been some sort of movement that happens, and then suddenly your patient's in respiratory distress, and they want to know that you know to go look and see how deep is this ET tube? Did it get pulled out, pushed in? Is my tube in proper placement? And they actually recommend in much literature that once you move a patient that we repeat a chest x-ray just to make sure that we have the same placement of the tube. We don't chest x-ray every time we move a patient, but we do watch the depth of the tube because that's a big indicator of where the other end of that tube is. You also have a little balloon that comes off the side here. This balloon connects to this cuff. Very similarly to a urinary catheter. So you put in a urinary catheter, you want to blow up the balloon on the catheter, you put saline into the side port, which inflates the cuff on the balloon on the catheter, right? This is the same cuff here, port comes off the side. For most trachs and ET tubes, we don't use liquid, we use air rather than liquid. There are some trach tubes that we use saline, but that's the exception, not the rule, and they're going to let you know if that's what kind of trach your patient has. So once this is in the patient, this holds, most of our cuffs are 10 cc's. We're going to have a 10 cc syringe on it. They inflate the cuff in place, and what this does is keep anything from going by this tube in the trachea. So the patient can't have air go around the tube, which means that it can't pass air, they can't pass air across their vocal cords, which means they should not be making any noises, and they can't have saliva, secretions, whatever, go the other way, which should decrease the risk of ventilator-associated pneumonia, which means that they have all this wonderful bacteria in their mouth that's leaked back down into their lungs following that tube, and they wind up with a big pneumonia from that. So I love me some Denzel Washington. I don't know how many of y'all know who Denzel Washington even is, because I'm getting old. Y'all know who Denzel Washington is? He made a movie named John Q. I feel like Denzel and I would have married if he had ever met me, but he didn't. And so I love my husband, unless Denzel comes to town. So Denzel Washington did a movie called John Q. It is a great movie. I think you should all watch it, but not before your next test. And in that movie, his son gets intubated. He's in the emergency department. He has this tube hanging out of his mouth. He's hooked to the ventilator. It's very dramatic. Denzel Washington is perched over his bed. And the little boy looks at Denzel, I'm watching this with my husband, and says, "Daddy, I love you." And my husband's like, "Oh my gosh." And I'm like, "Y'all need to check the placement of that tube, because he should not be able to talk with an ET tube in place." And my husband is very upset with me because I ruin everything. But people with ET tubes should not be making noises. If they are, you have a problem, because you are not ventilating the way you are supposed to. Air is crossing their vocal cords, and it should not be. So I've walked into a patient's room before, and they were given a breathing treatment to my patient on the vent. And you know how you can see the cloud of the nebulized treatment? The patient had smoke coming out of their mouth, and I was like, "Oh, well, I won't say that." We have a problem at 16. Where's a respiratory therapist? Because it should be a closed system. All of the air exchange is happening within the tube and the ventilator system. Nothing should be coming out of their mouth. That patient had been on the vent for a while and had used their tongue to push their tube out, and this cuff was sitting in their mouth. They had curled their tube up in their mouth. So I was still 22 at the lip, but I was not ventilating the patient with the vent. They were breathing in sync with the vent, so I didn't have anything alarming. And the first thing that we knew that there was a problem was that he had breathing treatment coming out of his mouth, which is not normal. Before we talk about these others really quickly, let's talk about these. I thought I had a slide on those, and I don't. Oropharyngeal airways and nasopharyngeal airways are also temporary measures. Y'all have seen an oropharyngeal airway when you took CPR, probably. It looks like this, and it's hard plastic. And all it does is hold your soft palate and your tongue apart from each other. A nasopharyngeal airway is usually about this long. Some people call them a nasal trumpet. It's usually about this long. They're about that big around. They're real floppy, and they have like a little flange on the end of them. And we put them in people's noses for the same reason, to hold the soft airway open. The most common place that you see people have these is when they're rolling out of the operating room, out of recovery, into ICU. We're not sending people to the floor with these in because they're not awake yet if we still have these in place. But they'll come, they'll extubate in surgery and throw one of these in because the people are still really sleepy, but they're breathing on their own to hold soft tissue apart. And then they'll come out to recovery with them. And sometimes they come out to ICU still with them, because our admission criteria are very different than a regular med-surg ward. And when they get to us, my nurses always ask me, "When do we take this out?" And I said, "When they pull it. When they wake up enough that that's irritating them and they pull it, we're good. Because if they're awake enough to do that, they're awake enough to hold the soft tissue open." But they're just a temporary measure. Now, you never, ever, ever put a oropharyngeal airway in someone who has an active gag reflex. Because if you do, they're going to vomit, and then they're going to aspirate. Because they were not awake enough, or you wouldn't have it in them. And so we're going to wind up with a situation. That's bad. We don't want that to happen. You'll also see sometimes, if we have people in a code, before the physician gets there and intubates, they'll put in an oropharyngeal airway when they're bagging, because it makes it easier for you to bag, because it kind of creates a path for you to bag them and get airway in. Okay. So assistance with intubation. If you have a doctor that's coming to the bedside to intubate, or a nurse practitioner or a PA, you're going to have some equipment ready. You need to have a suction set up, because before they intubate, they're going to suction really good in their mouth, because we don't want to get secretions down the lungs when we intubate. You're going to have a yonker or a suction catheter or something. Y'all know what a yonker is, right? That hard plastic thing you suction your mouth up with. You need your tube. You need some lubricant. We use sterile KY jelly to put on that tube, just to make it easier for them to get the tube down. It kind of lubes the way. If the patient is having horrible pulmonary edema and foaming at the mouth and all that, they don't need any lube. It's wet enough. They're good. So don't think they're wrong if they don't use it. But we use it most of the time. You need a stylet. If you tried to start an IV without having a needle inside your catheter, could you do that? No, but we don't leave the needle in. Once we get the IV in, we pull the needle out. It's the same thing with an ET tube. It's not a needle, but we have a thin piece of plastic-coated metal that we put inside the ET tube to give it a little oomph, so that when they put the ET tube in, it kind of holds its shape, and once they get it in the right place, they pull the stylet out. So we usually go ahead and open the ET tube, get the stylet in, and bend it over. It's very important that the stylet not stick out the end of the ET tube, because we don't want them to poke a hole in their trachea as they intubate. We also, most of our doctors now use a laryngoscope, which is kind of like a bronch mouth. It's a small camera that they can use that they put in the patient's mouth. They can actually see the airway on a little camera, a TV screen right there, and they watch the TV screen as they put the ET tube in. Probably 80-90% of our interpatients, we use a laryngoscope now. We keep them in the ED. We keep them in ICU. It's rare for them not to, but some of our old school docs learned how to do it without that, and so they're like, I can intubate fine. Why would I use that? And they'll use just a blade and a handle to do that. You're also going to need a back valve mask, or we call it AMBU bag is what you're going to hear in the hospital, but that's a brand name. So a valve bag mask or back valve mask is what you're going to see on NCLEX with 100% O2, because if we're needing to intubate someone, we're going to hyperoxygenate before they start, because we're going to have to quit bagging them while they intubate. We want to make sure they're hyperoxygenated. We want a continuous O2 sat on their finger, and then we're going to have our medications, and there's options for medications. Sometimes they just give a little propofol IV push to give them a little something-something to make them not be uncomfortable and fight while we're putting the tube in. Sometimes they give them a sedative and follow it with a paralytic. We call that rapid sequence intubation, and we're going to talk about that more in just a minute. But what medications they choose are going to be partially dependent upon patient condition. If we have someone who's pretty lethargic already, they probably don't need a whole lot of meds. If we're in the midst of a code and they have no pulse, we're not giving any meds because they're not responding. And then it's going to be also dependent upon the doctor, because doctors have favorite meds they use. And so sometimes we know what we're going to push before we start based on what doctor's coming to intubate. So rapid sequence intubation, RSI, is identified by the State Board of Nursing as a method that we use to rapidly intubate someone who needs to be intubated by pushing a combination of drugs, a sedative, and then a paralytic or a neuromuscular blocker. It's important for you to know about RSI. You're going to have specialized training once you graduate and go to work for a hospital as an RN to say that you are RSI certified. That's required by the State Board of Nursing. Every hospital does that a little bit differently. But once you have specialized education on RSI, it gives you an out of giving you the ability to do something that no one else can do and in no other situation you can do, which is to give IV push propofol. Propofol is an anesthetic. It is not within an RN's scope of practice to give IV push propofol. We are allowed to run it on a pump as a continuous infusion for patients who have a protected airway, as in they have a trach or an ET tube, for sedation while receiving mechanical ventilation. But we cannot give it IV push. It is not in our scope of practice, except for when assisting a physician with RSI. So if a doctor is doing a bronch at the bedside and says, hey, give them 5 cc's of propofol IV push, can you do that? Not unless you're a CRNA. But if they're intubating and you're doing RSI, then yes, you can do that if you are RSI certified. Now, what I've done many times is pulled up 5 cc's of propofol, put it on the IV, and held it out to him. I mean, I'll get it ready for him, but I am not practicing outside of my scope of practice. I work too hard and we're too hungry. And so I can't lose my job because I was out there in an area where I'm not supposed to be. You will be asked to do it within your first year of practice. If you work in ICU, I can almost guarantee you. You will see other nurses choose to do it. I highly encourage you not to, because the one time something goes wrong and the physician says, I didn't push that, she did, you are in a world on an island all by yourself alone because you practiced outside your scope of practice. It's just not worth it. Help them. Pull it up. Put it on there. Hand it to them. That's fine. But you don't push it unless it's in an RSI situation. So we use RSI for patients who are either uncooperative. We have people that come in. Have you ever heard of Flocka? Flocka? I don't really know what Flocka is. Like, if Flocka walked up to me and said, hello, I'm Flocka, I wouldn't recognize it. But it is a street drug, similar to bath salts. I don't know, but that's all I know about it. I know it makes people crazy. I know that they have superhuman strength. We have seen a patient in the ED at North pick up a stretcher and throw it across a room, which should not be humanly possible, but Flocka does stuff to them. They fling themselves about. They take their clothes off. We had a guy jump off a stretcher and break both of his tibias because they've been on Flocka. I don't know if you smoke it, snort it, shoot it up. I don't know. Y'all can tell me later. But what? her how she knows that. But it is some bad stuff. She's Googling. She showed me her phone. FLAKKA, I think, or FLAK. She doesn't know how to say heroin. That makes me feel better. It's a mix between heroin and crack cocaine. And there's something else in it, isn't there? They're looking up the recipe. They'll share it with you later. But it is and bath salts. I know it was related to bath salts in some way. I don't know who decided to smoke some bath salts, but it's some bad stuff. And if y'all go on YouTube and put Flocka in, you'll see videos of people standing on top of buildings, acting crazy, and it's the drug. And we have a lot of it in our area here. That and meth are very common here. And so we have patients that come in, there is no way to keep them safe. They don't have anything wrong with their respiratory status, but we will give them a sedative and a paralytic, take them out, put them on a vent, and keep them sedated to give time for the medications to wear off, whatever they are. And sometimes we know what they've taken, sometimes we don't. A lot of that, like synthetic marijuana, we have people that do that as well. People do synthetic marijuana because it doesn't show up on the drug screen, hopefully. But you don't really know what's in that. And we've had some people have some really bad outcomes from that. Head injuries, maybe not because they're having respiratory issues, but because they have neurological problems now. They're not protecting their airway or not don't know to breathe. If they have some sort of injury to a major vessel, like have y'all done trauma yet? So y'all are going to learn about crushing chest injuries, that kind of stuff. If you have an aortic trauma or something, we need to get this patient down, not moving, before they go to surgery or whatever. An asthma exacerbation, reactive airway disease, or seizure patients, because we also know that they can't protect their airway either. Now, keep in mind that when we give that sedative and that paralytic, the seizure is going to stop, right? The muscular contractions are going to stop because we've blocked them with the drug, but the brain is still seizing. So don't be surprised if you have a patient that's seizing, if they give a sedative and neuromuscular blocker, we get them intubated to protect their airway, but they still have to treat the seizure because the patient is still seizing, which can cause damage to their brain if we don't stop that. But all of these patients would be candidates for RSI. There are some contraindications. If they have some weird distorted airway, like the person I told you earlier that has the fused neck that we can't tilt their head, they may not want to do RSI on them. We may not want to knock everything out. They may want to lightly sedate them and see if we can get the tube in to where we haven't knocked out their whole drive to want to breathe. If they have an airway obstruction, we've knocked out their respiratory drive, but we can't get a tube in. We haven't helped them. Major facial laryngeal trauma, like the patient I told you earlier, we had a gunshot wound come in before that their nose looked perfectly normal, and then from here down, it was just red. You couldn't tell where a mouth even was. They may not use RSI on them because they're worried about losing their airway. And then angioedema, I've seen them do RSI on angioedema. I think it depends on how bad it is, but textbook was angioedema is a contraindication. There has to be an MD at bedside, and it does create some exceptions for you. We talked about propofol already. Etomidate is another drug that we can't push because it's an anesthetic, except for in an RSI situation. I've never been asked to push etomidate in a non-RSI situation. I've been asked many times to push propofol when it wasn't RSI, and I have not ever done it. I can say I've not ever done that because I'm a rule follower, and I don't want to get in trouble. And I would be the person who went to jail for jaywalking. Keep in mind that the doctor has to be there. I was a brand new nurse. I've been a nurse for about a year, and we had a little float nurse that came to my unit one day, and Dr. Taylor had called and said, you know, Zadie G looks worse. We're going to have to wind up intubating this patient. I need a 702, a MAC3 blade. I can tell you what Dr. Taylor used at the bedside, and we're going to give this drug and this drug. And she said, okay, thank you. And she said, he's coming to intubate. We said, okay. So she starts pulling all her stuff in there, and then she comes out of the room and she's okay, the meds are given. How long do you think you'll be here? And it was like a movie. Like, we all looked at each other, jumped up, ran in the room because she had sedated and paralyzed the patient, but the doctor wasn't there to intubate them yet. So we're bagging on the phone with Dr. Taylor saying, hey, come intubate now, meds are given. Don't give the meds until the doctor is there, okay? The doctor is there, the suction is set up, the bag is ready, we're on the monitor, all of that happens before we push meds. Once the doctor doctor gets the tube in place, the first thing we have to do is confirm placement of the tube. There's two tubes in the back of your throat. You have an esophagus and a trachea, and the tube needs to go down the trachea. But they can miss and go down the esophagus. It happens quite frequently, actually, especially if there's a lot of secretions and they have a hard time seeing. So we need to make sure it's in the right place. So when the tube's in, as soon as the doctor gets the tube in, you're going to see them pull the stylet out, put the AMBU bag on, and start bagging the patient. Somebody needs to have some ears. You're going to put your stethoscope in, and you're going to listen here, here, and here. And what you're listening for is, yes, breath sounds. Yes, breath sounds. No, gastric sounds. Because if they miss and put it in the esophagus, you're going to hear it just like if you're checking placement on an NG tube. You're going to hear gurgling when they bag. If you're not sure, not sure, and they go here and go, oh, yeah, they're going to pull out, bag again, and then we'll try again in just a second. If you hear breath sounds in this side or in this side and not this side, and you don't hear gastric sounds, then they're in the trachea, but probably what he did was intubate too far, and the tube has gone down the right main stem, so we're only inflating one lung when we bag. It can go either way, but because of the angle of the bronchus, it's more likely it go down the right side than the left side. So we don't pull the tube out. We'll just say, only breath sounds on the right. They'll pull it back a centimeter. So listen again. Only breath sounds on the right. They'll pull it back a centimeter. Okay, now I have bilateral breath sounds, and he'll say, okay. So that's the first way of confirming, is that we have positive breath sounds, bilateral breath sounds, negative gastric sounds. That's one way. The second way that you're going to see most people confirm is with a CO2 detector. So we have a little thing that goes between the ET tube and the AMBU bag. I didn't bring my display today to show y'all. But it's got a little wafer in it that is purple and yellow. So yellow means yes. If there's a high level of CO2 that passes by the wafer, it turns it yellow because of a chemical reaction. So when you pull it out of the bag, it's purple. You put it on there, you bag the patient, and you should see that when you bag, it's purple, and when you let go, it turns yellow. Because as the patient exhales CO2, it makes that wafer turn yellow. So that would be my second method of confirmation, that I have a yellow wafer on my CO2 detector or a positive result on my CO2 detector. They may be doing both of those things simultaneously. You have to have two methods. Those are the two methods you're going to most often see. They're probably going on together because while I'm bagging to listen, I can be watching my CO2 detector too, right? So it's not that one takes priority over the other, but those are my two methods. There's another method that's out there that I didn't even put on the slides, but you'll see it still in books sometimes. I've never seen it used in practice. But you know those little ball thingies that they put in babies' noses to suck snot out? They have a thing that looks very similar to that, and what they'll do is they'll bag the patient, clamp the tube, or they'll use the little bulb they put on the end and inflate like they've given the patient a breath with that bulb, and then they'll let go to see if the bulb reinflates or not. If the tube is in the esophagus is all floppy, the trachea is stiff, and so if that thing reinflates, you're assuming that it's in a tube that has hard walls, and so it must be in the trachea. You can understand why we don't do that so much. I couldn't even remember how to say it without thinking about it. We don't see people do that, but in some crash carts, you'll still find one of those things. And when I found that, I was like, are we sucking out baby's noses? What are we doing? That's what it's for, to be another method of confirmation. What you're going to see in clinical are the breath sounds and the intel CO2 detector. After we know the tube is in the right place, they're going to secure the tube to the patient. We used to use tape. We have devices now that will clamp in and put on the patient's face to hold it in place. And then we will let x-ray come in to do a chest x-ray. Chest x-ray is not your primary confirmation of placement. Because if we're waiting on them to shoot a chest x-ray and then for the doctor to look at it before we know that the tube is not in the esophagus, we have brain damage, right? That's a long time, even though it's digital and at the bedside now and all that. But it may take x-ray 10 minutes to get there to do your chest x-ray. So yes, you need to do it. Yes, it is expected after every intubation that there's a chest x-ray. But your primary confirmation is the breath sounds, no gastric sounds, that's all one thing, and the CO2 detector, okay? When they get their chest x-ray, They can't tell if it's in the trachea or the esophagus. What they can tell is where it is in relation to the carina, which I showed y'all when we looked at chest x-rays on the CV surgery lecture, to see is it too deep in or not deep enough. So the doctor may give you an order after the chest x-ray saying advance the tube 1 centimeter or pull back the tube 2 centimeters or whatever, based on how deep the tube is in the patient's chest. So you're going to document what this ET tube was at intubation, 22 at the lip or whatever. And then if the doctor says pull back 1 centimeter, then you're gonna put notified RT of orders, pull back now 21 at limp or whatever, so that you can show that we had that movement. Because then when you hand that patient off to other people, we need to know where the ET tube was supposed to be. So here's a chest x-ray. I told y'all, I'm not a radiologist, okay? But what I do know, which lung do we think looks better? This one or this one? You are correct, it's this one. Air is black on x-ray, and we expect air to be in lungs. This lung isn't great. It's got a lot of cloudiness going on here, but there's definitely a lot more black here than here. This is actually a chest x-ray I found online that is a patient who had surgery done, and when the CRNA intubated them for surgery, they didn't realize that the tube went too deep. So what did they not do? They didn't do their breath sounds. Or if they did, they didn't recognize they didn't have them on the left side. So this patient had a several hour long surgery done with their ET tube only in their right lung, which means their left lung just laid there still and didn't move at all because we did general anesthesia on this patient, and their chest filled up with fluid because the body doesn't like things to lay absolutely still. And so it filled them up with fluid because they were intubated down their right main stem. This is their ET tube here, and this should end like up here, but it didn't. It came all the way down here. So this patient had to go to ICU. They pulled the tube back a couple centimeters, and by the next day, their chest x-ray was almost normal because they were very healthy before this surgery. I think it was like a gallbladder or something. It wasn't actually something that was very long, and it was a healthy patient other than what they were having done. So they recovered very quickly, but you can see how if you don't do all the things they tell you to do, that a patient can have a negative outcome. Oops. From us missing a step. So these steps are very important. So here is a picture of a patient who's being intubated. This is hard. People have a hard time understanding how this works. So I put this picture in just so that y'all can see it. This is a laryngoscope rather than this is a blade and handle rather than a laryngoscope. So this is the old school way, but you're still going to see this. You have these on your crash cart because you may not have a laryngoscope available if you have a patient that crashes in CT or something. This handle and blade have a light on it that light the back of the airway to help the physician see back there. You can see that this one is curved. That's called, you don't have to know this for testing purposes. I'm just telling you because I can't help myself. But this is a Mac blade, which I always remember because they're curved Mac apples round. And then there's a Miller blade, M-I-L-L-E-R, that's a straight blade that goes straight like this. L's are tall and skinny, so that's how I remember which one's which. Mac's curved, Miller's tall. It also says it on the blade, so you don't have to memorize that. And right here on the blade, it will tell you Mac 3, Mac 4. The number tells you how big it is. Mac 3s and 4s are what we most often use in adults. So if you have a doctor coming, you don't know what they need, you don't have a laryngoscope, grab a 3 and 4 and have it ready, because that's probably what you're going to use in adults. Zeros, like, it makes me sad that they even make them. They're a little bitty tiny. That's why I don't work in NICU. And then this is your ET tube here that's gone down into the back of the throat, into the trachea, and stops right here. And then here's your little balloon off the side that's going to inflate your cuff. You didn't realize how big your tongue was, did you? Trach tubes, if we have somebody that's going to have long-term ventilation, we prefer to move them over to a tracheostomy. And by long-term, I'll tell you, at 2 weeks, we need to be making the move. Anytime you have something man-made stuck into a mucous membrane in a person, it creates pressure points. It can cause problems going through the vocal cords. So we keep somebody that's orally intubated for a month. If we do get them extubated, they may not ever be able to talk again because they may have paralysis in their vocal cords from that tube being through the vocal cords. And they can wind up with a fistula between their trachea and their esophagus where that balloon is inflated. It can actually cause it to erode and create a leak between the two. So at about 2 weeks, you're going to hear the doctors start talking to family about maybe doing a trade. If it's somebody that we know is not going to recover quickly, they may start talking 24 hours into intubation about a trade because they know they're not going to improve dramatically over the next 2 weeks. We also use trachs if they have an upper airway obstruction. We had a patient that came out one time that was a carotid, was doing great, and they had a suture line pop in their neck where they had just had that carotid endarterectomy done. And when that suture line popped, it created a huge hematoma in a short period of time that occluded the patient's airway. So we had to do an emergency trach at the bedside to get their airway back. And then they went to surgery to be repaired from where that suture line popped. They were absolutely fine. They didn't have any long-term deficits. But it was an all of a sudden, oh my gosh, we're doing an emergent trach at the bedside. And if they can't do a trach, they can do a crike, which is just, it's kind of like a trach, but in a different place, to get an airway quickly in someone who has an obstruction above that point. We also do it for trauma and for people who have neuromuscular diseases. Like if we had a guy that had Guillain-Barré, that did not get treatment early, and y'all know Guillain-Barré is the one that starts at your feet and works its way up. It's that demyelinating neuromuscular disease. But he didn't get treatment. He was a truck driver driving across country, and about halfway through his trip, noticed that he had weakness in his feet, and several days later thought, okay, I can't get out of the truck now, but he finished his load before he came back here, had his wife with him on his trip, and by the time he got here, he was so far into the disease that even though we treated him, it kept going. We couldn't stop it. And so he wound up trached for the rest of his life because he did not have the strength to keep his airway open and to breathe on his own without ventilatory support. So what are advantages to a trach? It keeps you from having all those oronasal, pharyngeal, and laryngeal secretions roll through that tube back into your lungs and cause a ventilator-associated pneumonia. It also keeps from having breakdown. People who are on the vent for a long time, we have to worry about all of their mucous membranes. They'll get breakdown on their lip. They'll get breakdown on their tongue. As a matter of fact, y'all saw the story of Lee White. It was all over 2020 and all that, so I'm not breaking HIPAA. But Lee White is our patient safety officer at Willis Knighton North, and she was one of our first COVID patients that wound up on the vent long-term that recovered. And so that's why it made national news, because people were not recovering from COVID at that point. But we did a little yay Lee as she left the hospital, and Willis Knighton posted on social media, and the next morning it was on Good Morning America, and then it was on 2020, and she's been interviewed by everybody. It's crazy. She's our own little superstar. But she is having to have surgery on her tongue because she was intubated for 12 days, and the pressure of the tube in her mouth on her tongue has caused a spot that they're having to go in and remove because it won't heal. Nobody did anything wrong. It's just you have hard plastic man-made stuff stuck in an area that's not supposed to have that on it all the time, and it's caused a problem for her. Trachs are also shorter and wider than ET tubes are. So if you think about it, I used to do this when all of my students were in the same room, that I would bring in a regular straw like you buy at Walmart, and then y'all know those teas they make? Have y'all seen the straws that come with them? They're like this big around. So if I give you the regular straw like you buy at Walmart with the bendy thing in it and say, here, you have this, and I cut off a section about this long of that really big straw that comes with the loaded tees, and I say, okay, we're going to start a contest to see who can breathe through this the longest. Who do you think is going to win? I am with the short, fat straw over the person who's got the long, skinny straw. Same concept with trachs and ET tubes. It's shorter and fatter, so it's easier to breathe through. It has less air resistance. So if we have somebody that we just can't get off the ventilator, we can't wean them, we may actually be able to wean and pull the trach if we put a trach in them, whereas we may never get them off the vent if we have an ET tube because it's harder to breathe through an ET tube. It's also less curved. So shorter, wider, and less curved all lead to less air resistance, all lead to less work of breathing. It also makes it easier to remove secretions because they're right there, and it's a lot easier for somebody to cough secretions up to here than to cough secretions up to here. And so it's easier for them to keep their own airway clean as well. It's way more comfortable. You wouldn't think that it would be because you have to make a surgical incision in someone's neck. But imagine having to have your mouth open for 2 weeks and not being able to close it. Like, that's not comfortable. I can't imagine. Y'all would have to restrain me if I'm intubated. They can eat and talk. We have what's called a passe-muir valve or a talk valve that we can put in trachs. which is a plug that goes in that allows them to inhale through their trach. It's a one-way valve. It allows them to inhale through their trach, but it doesn't allow them to exhale here. So the air is forced up, which means it passes over their vocal cords, which means they can talk. So they still get the ease of breathing, of pulling air in here. We're not plugging off their trach completely, but it looks like that kind of. But then when they exhale, it goes across their vocal cords. They do have to learn to talk with those. It's different than we talk, but they can. They can learn to do that, which gives them their voice back, which is really nice. And they also can eat with those too. If you're putting a talk valve in someone, never put a talk valve in without deflating their cuff first. Because what's going to happen if their cuff is inflated and you put a valve on? It allows them to inhale, but they can't exhale through their trach. And they can't exhale around their trach either because you have their cuff inflated. So they die. That's bad. Or turn blue. Hopefully you figure out if they turn blue, take the talk valve out. But you should always deflate the cuff on their trach before you put the talk valve in so that they have a place to exhale around the trach. And it's much easier to wean them. So a trach is made up of parts. You have the trach itself, which is made out of plastic or metal. Most of our trachs are plastic, but there's still a few guys running out there living trach for 20 years that have a metal trach. We don't put them in very often now at all, but they'll come in with other things wrong with them, and oh, by the way, they have a metal trach. You have the tube itself. You have the cuff, which y'all know what that is, the balloon that inflates on the end. You have the obturator, which is kind of like the stylet when we're intubating. It's a small, skinny, hard piece of plastic that we put in the trach to insert the trach, and then you pull it out so that they can breathe through the hole in the middle. The obturator should always be kept at the bedside of a patient who has a trach, because if they cough their trach out, get hold of it, pull it out, we pull it out on accident as we turn them, whatever. You can't get the trach back in the patient without having an obturator to put in to make it stiffer so that it will go in the hole. And a fresh trach, if we had a patient that got trached yesterday and you turn them today and their trach comes out, if it took the physician 5 minutes to get there, that hole may be too small to get that trach back in. They close that fast. Now, if somebody's been trached for 20 years and has a metal trach, it ain't gonna close. They've had it for 20 years or scar tissue, they're gonna be okay. And you don't need an obturator for a metal trach anyway because it's stiff, right? But if it's a fresh trach, it will close very, very quickly. I've had a patient before, it wasn't my patient, but a patient in one of my units that coughed while the nurse was doing trach care and coughed their trach out. She screamed. Critical care doctor was in the unit, ran in there, had the obturator, couldn't get it back in, and to keep from losing the trach site, he got an ET tube and stuck it in their trach because it was a little bit skinnier than the trach, and secured that to them, and we had that hooked into the vent because we were using it like it was a trach, even though it was an ET tube, so it was hanging out this far. So those holes can close very quickly. And then some of them have an inner cannula. They don't all, but most of them have an inner cannula. Those inner cannulas can either be disposable, which is what we see more often than not now, or they can be reusable. So when y'all learned how to do trach care in second level, if they had a reusable trach, you pulled it out, and what did they teach y'all to clean the cannula with? We just use saline now. Just saline? Hydrogen peroxide. So everybody used to clean with hydrogen peroxide. The newest literature says that hydrogen peroxide actually causes breakdown to the skin in the trach. And so even though that's why you're supposed to rinse it off before you give it back to them, but we do not use peroxide at all now. We just use saline to clean our trach, inner cannula, and then it goes back in the patient. Most of our patients have a disposable inner cannula, which is even nicer. You pull the inner cannula out, you throw it away, you get another one, you put it in. There is no cleaning because it's just a thin piece of plastic and it's disposable. The tracheotomy, not tracheostomy. Tracheostomy is a hole. Ostomy is hole, right? Tracheotomy is cut. So this is the surgical procedure we use in order to have a tracheostomy. So a tracheotomy leads to a tracheostomy, okay? You have two options for a tracheotomy. They can do an open or a percutaneous. Open, they go to surgery, they use a scalpel, they slice through the skin. It's an open procedure. A percutaneous means that they stick rather than cut. We do percutaneous tracheotomies at the bedside at ICU all the time at North. They usually have an intensivist and a surgeon at the bedside, and the intensivist will put the laryngeal or the bronchoscope down and light at the site, and then the surgeon will poke, put in the trach, and we pull the tube out while the trach's going in all at one time. It takes less than 5 minutes. It takes longer to set up than it does to do the procedure. When they have an open procedure, they're quite bloody. They don't hurt. They look like they hurt. They don't. The patients don't complain of much pain, but they're quite bloody. So that first dressing when they come out of the OR is usually pretty saturated. That first few hours, they're going to have, it's not going to be running down their chest. If that's happening, you need to call somebody. But it's more blood than you would anticipate, probably, just because there's some very superficial vessels there. With the percutaneous trachs, we don't see that as much, which is why they tend to do those. Complications, they can bleed. The tube can be misplaced. It can cause laryngeal nerve injury. So if that happens, they're not going to be able to talk normally anyway. They can get a pneumothorax, a pneumomediastinum, which is just air in the mediastinum instead of lung space, or they can code, which would be a result of any of these other things that are happening. If we lose our tube, if we pulled our ET tube out and we can't get the trach in place and they can't get them reintubated, they're going to code because we can't oxygenate them. But trachs are very quick. It's rare that we see a negative outcome from them, but those are the things you're at risk for. We always think about them because you're doing surgery on someone's airway and they can't leave without an airway. So if you pick up a patient, you go in and get report and the patient is intubated on the vent. One of the things these are the things you're gonna do or assess on a patient who's intubated. First of all, oxygen is dry. And we know if y'all have ever had even a nasal cannula of your own, it makes your nose dry, it makes it crack, it starts to bleed, it burns, it's irritating, it's not fun. So you can imagine if we have high flow oxygen that's not humidified, how irritating that would be to their lung tissue, because we're delivering it right here at almost the start of their lungs. So we humidify that oxygen, but we don't necessarily humidify it with a humidifier like you think about with the nasal cannula. So there is a way that you can do it with a bottle of water, but what you see more often than that is they have a little green, ours are green, wafer thing that's in the tubing going from the vent to the patient. It's called an HME, humidified. You can Google that for me too and tell me what HME stands for, but it's called an HME. And as the patient exhales, the moisture from their breath, because like if you go, you know, there's moisture in there. I won't shake any of your hands. The moisture from them exhaling collects in that filter so that the next time the vent gives them a breath, they're like auto-humidifying their own oxygen. So it's not like we have a mist going off. It's just that the humidity from them breathing out then humidifies their breath in. If you have a patient who has a lot of secretions, it actually can get really wet and they'll have to change that out. They change it out with their tubing anyway every 3 days or however often RT does that. But they may have to do it more often if the patient has a lot of secretions. Did you look it up? Heat moisture exchanger. There you go. I always try to make the HME humidify, but we all call it an HME. And I think I have a picture in a minute. I'll show you what that looks like. You're also going to watch your cuff. When you go in and assess a patient who's on the vent, you know you shouldn't be hearing sounds. They shouldn't be talking to you. That tells you that your cuff's inflated. You shouldn't have breathing treatment coming out around your tube. But you're also going to pick up that little balloon that's outside, and you're going to squeeze, squeeze, squeeze like that, and it should bounce back when you squeeze it. If you squeeze it and it goes flat and you let go and it doesn't reinflate, we got a problem. Either you need more air in your cuff has burst. We have that happen sometimes. What happens a lot is patients who are agitated will gnaw on that tube, and when they do, it will gnaw through the tubing that connects that outside balloon to the inside balloon. Well, then you can't hold air in your cuff because they've bit through the connector, so they'll have to change that tube out. And we use what's called a bite block. Ours are orange, but it's a hard piece of plastic that they'll put around the tube to protect that where their teeth are. It doesn't keep them from biting, but it gives them something hard to bite on instead of their tube, which is their airway. If their cuff is flat, you can put a cc or two of air in their cuff. If you're having to do that every few hours, you need to let somebody know, because that shouldn't be happening, and something's wrong with your tube if that's happening. You may have to suction these patients. What's usually recommended is when you pick up a patient, when you do your head-to-toe assessment, part of that should be to suction to see what secretions they have. That's the only time we usually schedule suctioning, is when you're assessing them. So you're going to want to listen to breath sounds and then suction and see what you get, and then listen to breath sounds again to see how did the suctioning clear it up. Because if you hear a lot of ronchi when you first listen and then you suction, it may have cleared all that up when you suction, in which case, that's great, but you need to know that. Suctioning is a sterile procedure. A long time ago, we used to have to sterile glove and open up all these kits, but now we have closed suctioning systems that it all has this little cover over it, similar to what I showed you with the PA catheter, that sleeve that's over it. So you don't have to sterile glove and all that because it's a closed system. You put on regular gloves. You're going to hyperoxygenate the patient for about 10 seconds before you suction to make sure they got all the good O2 going on. Then you're going to insert that catheter, hold down continuous suction, and pull back as you suction. That whole process shouldn't take longer than about 10 seconds. Because if you think about it, once you start sticking that tube in there, you've decreased the vent's ability to ventilate the patient. And then once you start suctioning, you're pulling out all their oxygen. So my critical care teacher made us, when we learned to suction, she would say, okay, you ready? And she'd make us go and hold our breath while we inserted the suction tube, held down suction, and pulled it back, because she said, if you run out of air, they probably have too. And so that was her way of making sure that we didn't suction for too long, but it really shouldn't be more than about 10 seconds. So you're going to suction. I can't hold my breath if it makes me cough. You're going to suction, and when you assess, so you can say they have a small amount of thin white secretions, which I consider to be pretty normal, or a large amount of purulent thick green secretions, which is not normal, and if we're not on antibiotics, we probably need to tell somebody. And then only when needed. We don't schedule it. Like, it's not something like, I can't think of anything else to schedule right now, one touches that we do four times a day. You're going to do it when they need to be suctioned. So how would you know they needed to be suctioned? Y'all all said stuff, but I didn't hear any of it. Breath sounds. If you listen and they have lots of ronchi and you suction and now they're clear and later in the shift they have a bunch of junk in their chest again, suction them again. You might be able to clear that up for them. What else? Alarms. The vent may be yelling at you saying, hey, I've got something. And we're going to talk about what those alarms are going to be in a minute. What else? They say... because they will do that sometimes. Suction me. I need you to suction me. They don't really enjoy being suctioned. It doesn't hurt, but it makes them cough a lot. Their face is going to turn red. Their eyes are going to water. And if you've never seen it happen, have y'all seen an ventilated patient get suctioned that's wide awake? It will scare you the first time. Something about there being no sound associated with it makes you forget they're just coughing. That's all that is. But it looks scary, especially to family. And you need to stay very calm. The vent's screaming because they're coughing. Their face is red. They're sitting up in the bed. Their eyes are teary. They have this awful look on their face. And their family thinks you just killed them. And you have to stay very calm and say, it's okay. They're just coughing. It just looks weird because you can't hear it. This is Denise. I'm lecturing at Northwestern, but you called me, so I stopped because it scared me. I have not heard a word. Our senior vice president of nursing says hello, and she's glad that you're all here today. All right, I'll call you later. That's all right, bye-bye. Y'all heard that ringtone. That's the nuclear meltdown ringtone. That's my boss. And so I was like, she knows where I am. I better answer that, but she had forgotten I was lecturing. I apologize for that. No other call I would answer, but that one I would. You need to warn them and you need to be very calm because it's very scary to them. What else might happen that you think they need to be suctioned? They start gagging or coughing a lot, or you walk in there and you see secretions going in and out of the tube every time they breathe because they have coughed them up and they're like, hey, can you get that for me? And you'll have to go in and get those secretions out. Complication of suctioning. If we suction, the reason why we don't schedule suctioning all the time is because, once again, we're putting a man-made hard object down into a soft tissue area. If we have somebody that's been intubated a while and we're having to suction them a lot because they have lots of secretions, after a while their secretions are going to start to be blood-tinged because we've caused irritation down in that tissue from the suction catheter. So don't be surprised if that happens. It's not that we're saying, hey, that's okay, we don't mind, we don't want it to happen, but it's pretty common. The patients also sometimes, when they get to coughing, if it gets them all riled up, if we're worried about their intracranial pressure, it can make their ICP go up. If they're very hemodynamically stable, it can make their blood pressure go through the roof, or it can bottom it out depending on the patient, what's going on with it. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And we've already talked about the procedure. These people also can't talk to you, unlike John Hughes' son, probably because he was related to Denzel Washington. And so you have to have some other alternative method of communication. Everyone who's intubated thinks that we can read lips, and I can't. I'm the worst lip reader in the world. So they will talk to you, and they will get so frustrated, and they'll be like, and I'm like, I don't know what you want. And then I'll think, oh, I know what it is, and I'll say it. And they'll be like, no, that's not it. They get so frustrated. Sometimes we'll give them a paper and pen. If they're on any kind of sedation at all, they will write and write and write and hand it to you, and it looks like hieroglyphics, and you're like, I don't know what that says, and they will get so frustrated. So we have some tools that we use. We have communication boards that have pictures of most common things, like I'm hot, I'm cold, I'm thirsty, whatever, I'm hungry, whatever. Not that we can go give them a glass of water, but we can rinse their mouth out with water and suction that out to try to keep them wet. Those work much better than traditional methods of communication. We had somebody that came in one time that was deaf, and they were on the ventilator, and they used sign language, and one of my nurses spoke sign language. That was the best. I felt like we should teach every patient how to use sign language, so that if you're ever intubated, we can communicate with you. But we do have other options, and then don't forget about the talk valve that you can use for trachs only, not for an ET tube. When we get ready to extubate a patient, they're going to suction, suction, suction. They're going to suction the ET tube, and they're going to suction all in the mouth and the back of the throat, because if there's anything that's in there, we want to get all that out before we pull the tube out, because it could go down into the lungs. They're going to sit them up in a high Fowler's, unless there's some reason they can't. I recommend you get a towel and put it across their chest, because you never know what's going to come out with that ET tube. You could have not been getting a lot of secretions at all, and there's going to be a big old loogie on the end of that when they pull it out, and then you're going to have to change gown and sheets and all that. So I recommend a big towel across here. Suction, suction, suction. Get all this undone where they have it taped to their face or with the device. Put a syringe on the balloon. They pull out the 10 cc's of air, so they should have a leak now. And they're going to say, okay, give me a big cough. And when they cough is when they pull that tube out laid on their chest, and then we can ball all that up and get rid of it. Complications they're going to have from that, they're going to have a sore throat, especially if the tube's been in a while. If they have stridor, y'all remember what stridor is? Can anybody show me what stridor sounds like? Nobody's going to do it, huh? There you go, I knew somebody would do it. And they may not look like they're in distress when it first happens, but if you have extubated somebody and they're going when they breathe, that is a problem. Because what that means is that they're trained and small enough that it's creating this whistling noise when we will do some racemic epinephrine as treatment for that. Racemic means nebulized. And then epinephrine, y'all know what that is. Epi causes tissues to clamp down, which seems weird because your airway's too small. But the reason why your airway's too small is because the tissue's all inflamed. So it actually makes the airway bigger to clamp down the tissue. Does that make sense? So we'll give them a treatment of racemic epi to get rid of that. And if that doesn't fix it, they're probably going to reintubate them. Because regardless of what their oxygenation status is, if they're like that, we don't know if that swelling's going to stop, and if we wait until it closes off their airway, we may not be able to get a tube in them, and we don't want that. So they are very aggressive with reintubation if we have stridor. Hoarseness can happen just because of the tube being in there. It can cause the vocal cords to not work quite right. Some people, you'll talk to some people sometimes, their voice sounds kind of funny. They'll say, yeah, I had surgery, and I've never talked right since, and it's a complication of having an ET tube. It doesn't happen very often, but it can. They can also aspirate. If we say cough, 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 and they have a weak cough, when we deflate that cuff, anything sitting on top of it can go down into their lungs, and we can wind up with a pneumonia. And they're going to cough. If that's the worst complication you have from extubation, you're doing really good. So why would we put somebody on a ventilator? Do y'all want to take a break? Are we good? Nobody's saying break here. Natchitoches, Alexandria, y'all okay?
We're good.
We're good. We're going to keep going then. Okay. Why would we put somebody, everything we've talked about has just been the airway itself, be it a nasopharyngeal, oropharyngeal, ET tube, or trach. We've only been talking about the airway. We have not talked about helping them with ventilation, which is the vent. There's many reasons we'd do that. It could be extrapulmonary, like a CNS neuromuscular problem, or intrapulmonary because they actually have a problem with the heart or lungs. You know, I always teach my students, the heart and lungs are married. You mess up one, you've messed up the other, almost instantaneously, and the kidneys are the other woman. In a few days, they're going to be in trouble too. So CNS reasons, we have some reason that we're not able to regulate our respiration, such as head trauma, CVA, head bleed, cord transection, there's your patient right there, or an overdose. You can have a neuromuscular problem, which means that the respiratory muscles themselves are not able to move, such as my guy with Guillain-Barré, MS, MG, poliomyelitis. We don't see that so much anymore, but a long time ago they did. It could be a muscular problem, which is the chest wall itself. Y'all are going to learn about flailed chest when y'all do the trauma lecture, and should, which is when you have a bunch of rib fractures and you have this little island of rib that's not connected on either side. And what happens when you breathe? If you think about me and you sitting here now breathing, not somebody that's on the ventilator, when we want to breathe, we contract our diaphragm, which drops the pressure in our chest, which then sucks air in from the room because it's being sucked in because we drop the pressure. So we are working to inhale. And then we relax our diaphragm and we passively exhale. So our respiratory pattern is inhale, exhale. We spend a lot more time breathing out than in because we work to inhale and then we passively exhale. Unless you have somebody who has COPD, and what do they look like? They inhale and work to exhale because of a pathology. When you have flailed chest, where you have this little island of ribs over here, when you contract your diaphragm to inhale, what's going to happen to this little island of ribs when the pressure in your chest drops? It's going to suck in. And then when you exhale and the pressure in your chest rises, it's going to balloon out. Now your chest, when you inhale, does what? Gets bigger, except for this one section that's going to suck in. So they say that they have paradoxical chest movement. They have a place in their chest that's moving in the wrong way, and that's called a flail chest. Well, mechanically, you cannot breathe as well when a portion of your chest is sucking in while you're trying to fill your lungs, right? So that would be a muscular problem that causes you to not be able to breathe well. Kyphosis. Y'all know lordosis is when you have a sway back like this. Kyphosis are those people that are bent over like this. It would make sense to you that it would be harder for them to expand their lungs if their back is all hunched over like that. Scoliosis is when you're this way. And some people's scoliosis is so bad that it inhibits their lungs. They usually do surgery on those. And then COPD is another example because they get all ballooned out and so big that their muscles can't work like they're supposed to when they have in that big chest. Pulmonary is the lungs itself, which is not necessarily a ventilation problem, but an oxygenation problem. Like I can get air down into the lungs, but I can't get the oxygen to go through the alveoli into the bloodstream and the CO2 to come from the bloodstream back into the alveoli, such as with ARDS, pneumonia, COVID. We've had a lot. We have a patient right now, 37 years old, on ECMO from COVID, because her lungs are so destroyed from the virus that she can't oxygenate on her own. 37 years old. Or it can be a cardiac problem, such as cardiac edema, which is pulmonary edema. Same thing. If your heart fails, fluid backs up into your lungs, and then you have a hard time oxygenating because all the fluid's in the way for the oxygen to change. So there's types of ventilators. Can we breathe through negative or positive pressure? Very good, because we just said we drop the diaphragm, drop the pressure in the chest, create a suction to inhale. So when they first started making ventilators, they said, you know what, we should mimic that. So they created these big things, which you can only ever see in history books. I don't know that you'll see them in a hospital around this area anyway. That's called an iron lung is what they called it, but it's a negative pressure ventilator. And what they would do is they would put a patient in here, and their head would stick out here. There's a seal here that's sealed around their neck, and then they would slide that up and seal it, and it's like a dive chamber that they would control the pressure in that metal tube. And when they dropped the pressure in the tube, what would happen to the pressure in their chest? that's in the tube where we drop the pressure. So what would they do? Inhale, because we drop the pressure in their chest, and when they got ready for them to exhale, they would turn the pressure, the suction off inside the tube, and so then they would exhale, because our resting state is exhale, right? So they were mimicking, they were using the pressure in the tube to do the work of the diaphragm, because, and they use this a lot for polio, because with polio, it made the diaphragm not be able to work like it was supposed to. So, cool, it was really smart that they figured that out until the patient needed anything done to any part of them other than their head, because you couldn't get to them. Can you imagine the skin breakdown these patients must have had? Because, I mean, do you think they were opening this every 2 hours and turning them? No. If they eat, where are they going to poop in that tube? It'd be really hard to take care of somebody when all you could get to was their head, right? They're huge. It's hard to get to the patient. It was cool technology. And if you Google, you can find lots of pictures of just halls and halls of patients laid out in iron lungs because of polio. But there were some downfalls to that. So they came up with positive pressure ventilators, and that's what you're going to see in our hospitals here. This is an example of one. This is another one. We have mostly these. These are kind of old school. This is a Servo I. That's a Servo 300. You don't have to know that, but I'm just telling you in case you see them in the hospital. There's others out there, but they're all positive pressure ventilator. So what that means is, when if I'm the ventilator for the rest of this lecture, I'm going to be a ventilator, and y'all are going to be all alveoli, okay? So if I'm the ventilator and it's time for you to breathe, I go, here, take this breath, right? Positive pressure. And then when it's time for you to exhale, I say, okay, and I back off. So it's a positive pressure ventilation. So as an alveoli, how do you already feel? It's a little stressful, right? Because is that how what you're used to? This positive pressure coming in at you saying you have to take this breath? Is that what we're used to? No, we're used to negative pressure. So in me and you not being on the ventilator, if we're looking at pressures in the chest, our pressures are inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. And on the vent, you suddenly become inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. So we've greatly increased the pressure inside the chest, which can cause some bad things to happen, and we'll talk more about that as we go on. So there are some things you're going to have to know. This is going to be very reminiscent of hemodynamics. So you're just going to have to learn some numbers, and you have to know what they mean, because you're going to see them on your ventilator settings. The first one is tidal volume. Tidal volume is the volume of one breath. It usually is 5 to 10 mils per kg of your body weight. Now, if you have a patient that comes in that's 600 pounds, their lungs did not grow as they gained weight. So the doctors will use ideal body weight instead of actual weight on some patients. That's why I always suck in when I'm standing by our critical care doctors, because they can look at anybody and estimate their weight within about 5 pounds, because they're doing it every time they do vent settings on someone. It's almost a game to them. So I suck in, turn sideways, and look at them like this every time I see them. They probably think something's wrong with me, but I just am always a little freaked out by the fact they're so good at estimating weight. So that's tidal volume. You have your respiratory rate. See, this is where things kind of go off the rails with the second term. Before we got to this lecture, if I asked you what a patient's respiratory rate was, what would you tell me it is? How many times they're breathing a minute? That's right, until you start talking about vents. And now suddenly you have two. You have two respiratory rates for each patient all the time, because you have the number of times they're breathing a minute, and then you have the number of times the ventilator is giving them a breath a minute. So if we ask what the respiratory rate, if they ask, what is your patient's respiratory rate? They are talking about the number of times they're breathing a minute. But if they say, hey, what's the rate? They want to know what the vent is set on. And so it becomes very confusing. So the respiratory rate on the vent is the number of times the vent is giving them a breath. So you may have a patient whose vent is set to give them 6 breaths a minute, but they're breathing 12. They're breathing over the vent. So in your vital signs documentation, you're going to document a respiratory rate of 12, because that's how many times they're breathing. But in your vent documentation on the same patient, you're going to document a respiratory rate of 6, because that's what's dialed into the ventilator. When we documented on paper, because I'm that old, we used to put 12 over 6, so that anybody could look and say, hey, they're breathing 12 times, but 6 of them are on the vent. because it showed that they were breathing over, which is good for a neurological status. You also have what's called, and it's not on here, so y'all need to add it, minute ventilation. So if we think about hemodynamics, let's think about cardiac output. You have stroke volume, which is the volume from one beat. You have heart rate, which is how many times you beat a minute. And you have cardiac output, which is heart rate times stroke volume, because that tells you the volume that you push out of the heart over 60 seconds, right? You have tidal volume, which is the volume of one breath. You have respiratory rate, which is how many times you breathe in a minute. You have minute ventilation, which is the volume of air that you breathe over 60 seconds. Hence the name minute ventilation. It's the amount you ventilate in a minute. There's also a setting that's on the ventilator that's called a sigh. Sitting here, maybe especially when I'm lecturing, I don't know, every once in a while, without you even thinking about it, you'll go, right? Your body does that subconsciously, not because you're frustrated, but because every once in a while, when we're sitting here breathing and y'all are all those alveoli that are out there, we're only using about a third to two-thirds of you to just sit here, right? You jump on a treadmill, you'll use more. But sitting here, you're using a third to two-thirds. And what did we learn about alveoli that sit still? They fill it with fluid. We don't want that. So every once in a while, your body, without you even thinking about it, will go and pop up open all those alveoli to say, hey, don't you be filling it with fluid. I might need you, right? Well, we do that. If we put somebody on the vent and sedate them, they don't do that anymore. And so there actually is a setting on the vent where they can hit a little button and it will force 1.5 times a normal tidal volume to pop open all those alveoli. We do not do that routinely because since you're on a positive pressure ventilator, if we did that, it could cause damage to all those alveoli. But it is there. I very rarely see anybody do a sigh on the vent anymore. We used to do it once a shift. Like, it used to be routine to do it once a shift just to say, okay, here, pop them all open. But what we saw is a lot of lung damage. And so the setting is still there. I very rarely see it done anymore. FiO2 is fraction of inspired oxygen, which is how much oxygen the patient's on. And it ranges from 21 to 100%. Does anybody know why? Why is there just not less than 21? Because room air is 21, and if we gave somebody less than 21% oxygen, it'd be like saying, I'm going to put a bag over your head and not let you have as much as we have. So we would never do that. So it's 21 to 100%. There is a little safety mechanism at 60% on our ventilators. What you have to do, if it's a knob, if it's a vent that has a knob, lots of times you have to push it in and turn to go past 60. If it's button electronic buttons like our vents, it kind of does a little, I'm pausing right here, are you sure you want to go above 60? Before you go above 60, I'm not saying we can't go above 60%, but we know that if we're giving somebody more than 60% oxygen, we're increasing the risk of oxygen toxicity, which is another negative effect of being on the ventilator. Oxygen is a chemical, just like every other chemical. It is less toxic than, say, cyanide, but it is still a chemical. Your body is used to breathing 21% oxygen. If we suddenly start delivering 100% oxygen directly on the tissue, it causes chemical reactions to happen on those nice pink mucous membranes that cause us to have problems in the future. That doesn't mean that we don't give it. If the patient needs it, we give it. But our goal is to wean their FiO2 down to 60% as quickly as possible. Because the risk of oxygen toxicity is much less if you're on 60% or less. It's kind of like the breaking point on what causes damage to the tissues. Now, brain damage is also bad. So if your option is be hypoxic, have brain damage, or get some oxygen toxicity, we're going to get some oxygen toxicity. But we'd like to get down to 60% as soon as we can. You also have what's called your IE ratio, which stands for inspiratory to expiratory ratio. So me and you, sitting here, not on the ventilator, our IE ratio is roughly 1 to 2 because we inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. Because we work to inhale, it's faster. We passively exhale, it takes longer. So if they don't set an IE ratio, if that's not part of your ventilator settings, it's going to default to roughly 1 to 2. Because that's what we do, and we try to make it as natural as possible, although the fact that we're on a positive pressure ventilator already made it very unnatural. But we can mess with that, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later. You also have a sensitivity. Similar to a pacemaker, you have a sensitivity on your ventilator. So, I am the vent, there's an ET tube, and y'all are all the alveoli out there, okay? When you want a breath, as the patient, when y'all go, ooh, need some oxygen, what do you do to initiate a breath? There's a muscle you contract. Your diaphragm, you contract your diaphragm to drop the pressure in your chest, right? That's how we breathe. You don't quit breathing that way just because we put a tube down your throat. How the vent reacts is very different, but we didn't change the human body. So when you say, need oxygen, the diaphragm contracts, it drops the pressure in the chest, and you got this tube sticking out of your mouth, and I go, ooh, they're sucking on the tube. That is called NIF. It is a negative inspiratory force. How it's them sucking on the tube saying, give me air, give me a breath. How much you have to NIF for me to say, okay, they want a breath, here you go, is the sensitivity of the ventilator. So let me give you an example. If you have an 80-year-old lady in there that had her gallbladder out, and she's got CHF and diabetes, and she's had a stroke in the past, she doesn't take real good care of herself, she's not compliant with her medications, but we had to get this gallbladder out, and she comes out to ICU on the vent, her NIF is probably not the same as his, right? So if I have my sensitivity on my vent set that they have to pull a certain amount for me to recognize it as a breath, and she's not pulling that much, what you're going to wind up is going in and looking at the vent, going, okay, they're on a rate of 12, and they're breathing 12 times a minute. And then you look at your patient, and they're going, because she's not pulling hard enough for the vent to register it as a breath. But how many times a minute is she breathing? 60? So as the nurse, you need to say, we've got a problem. And you need to notify a doctor, because they either need to change the sensitivity of the vent to register those breaths to support her, or to sedate her so that she quits breathing 60 times a minute, or to go up on her tidal volume so she doesn't want to breathe that many times a minute. But something needs to happen, because if she's laying in there flopping around like a fish breathing 60 times a minute, even though the vent's not registering it, she is wearing herself out. And what has she done to her oxygen demand if she's laying in there breathing 60 times a minute? She's running a race at 80 years old with a history of a stroke, with diabetes and heart failure and all those other things I just said. She's not going to have a good outcome. So that's why we'll tell you, don't nurse your monitors. Nurse your patient. Look at your patient. And if it looks like they're breathing 60 times a minute, they're breathing 60 times a minute. But we need to fix the equipment hooked to her so that we can capture that and treat her appropriately. You also have what's called pressure support. And we're going to do pressure support and PEEP, and then, no, we're not. So we'll talk about pressure support here. I had to think about how my PowerPoint is set up. Okay, so if I'm the ventilator, and y'all are all the alveoli, and you say, NIF, I want a breath, right? And I go, here, let me help you take this big, deep breath. That's pressure support. It is the pressure that's pushed by the ventilator on inhalation to help you inhale, to help you get a breath. And then when you get to the end of inhale and you go, okay, now I'm going to exhale, pressure support disappears because it is only there for inhalation. Let me help you take this big, deep breath, which is what makes me a positive pressure ventilator, because I give pressure support. Does that make sense? On the other hand, there's PEEP. PEEP is continuous. It is positive end expiratory pressure. So this is what happens. I'm the vent. You're all the alveoli. You sniff. I say, here, let me help you take this big, deep breath. What's that called? Pressure support. And then we go to exhale. Pressure support disappears. And the vent provides a small amount of pressure for you to exhale again. Why? Well, in you and I sitting here, let's be off the vent again and just talk about us. You inhale, contract your diaphragm. You inhale and fill your chest. and then you exhale passively. But right before the pressure in your chest equalizes the pressure in this room, there is a little trap door in the back of your throat that closes and says, uh-uh, that's enough. What's that called? Your epiglottis. Your epiglottis says, uh-uh, that's enough. Why? Because it leaves a little bit of air inside your lungs so that the alveoli do not deflate completely for several reasons. One, y'all ever blown up a balloon? What's the hardest breath to get in a balloon?
The first one.
So if I deflate my alveoli completely, I've greatly increased my work of breathing because the next breath I take, I have to start that first breath again. If I leave a little bit of air in my alveoli, then it makes it a lot easier to breathe because I'm not having to start from zero. Also, if you think about what you think an alveoli looks like, it's probably exactly what they look like. They're pink, they're moist, they're cute. If I have this cute little alveoli, well, maybe you probably didn't think cute, but I think it's cute. If I have this cute little alveoli that you exhale, it completely deflates. And every time you breathe, you have to go, what do you think inside that alveoli is going to look like? It's going to get all beat up, right? Like, it's not meant to do that. So, when we put an ET tube in somebody and we shove a tube down their throat, can their epiglottis close? So they can't say, that's enough. So the vent has to do that for them now. Your epiglottis creates about 3 to 5 centimeters of pressure gradient between your chest and the room. So most people who are put on the ventilator have 3 to 5 of peak built into their vent. So you say, I'm the vent, you're the alveoli, NIF, I go here, let me help you take this big deep breath, that's pressure support. You go to exhale, pressure support vanishes, and I have a little peep there that you blow out against, just 3 to 5 centimeters of water. Not much. Which keeps your alveoli partially inflated, decreases the work of breathing, makes it easier for your next breath, and keeps from having damage to the inside of that alveoli. It also decreases the risk of infection because your alveoli aren't all collapsed and been filling up with fluid. So that's peep. Let me help you take this big deep breath, pressure support, exhale against this, but keep your alveoli just a little bit open, beep. Y'all good so far? Okay. But we haven't talked about the modes of ventilation yet. We've just talked about some individual settings that can be on the vent. So we're going to start with the most, we're going to start on one end of the spectrum, and we're going to go to the other end of the spectrum on modes of ventilation. I'm going to tell you, you're never going to take care of somebody on control. We don't use it. But it gives us an absolute to start with, to then move towards the other absolute, which we use all the time. And everything in between the two we use. I'll also tell you there are many modes of ventilation out there, and I'm not talking about all of them because y'all are not going to school to be a pulmonologist. You're going to nursing school, and so I'm going to give you an introduction into some of the modes of ventilation. I am not in any way saying that every patient you take care of this semester is going to be one of these 5 modes. There's lots of them. There's combination modes. There's all kinds of things out there. But once you have the foundation, it makes it easier to learn about the additional ones, okay? So control, remember the rest of this lecture, I'm the vent, y'all are the alveoli. In control, I am in control, as in the vent. I control when you breathe. I control how much you breathe. I control how much oxygen you get. I control the pressures. You can NIF all you want, and I don't care. I am in control. So if you have a patient that's on a control mode with a rate of 12, with a 500 tidal volume, with 12 of pressure support and 5 of peak, they're going to be breathing 12 times a minute with a 500 tidal volume, with 12 of pressure support and 5 of peak. And there is no discussion because I'm the boss. Can you imagine? Can you imagine not being able to initiate a breath? Oops, I can't imagine. The only time that they used this mode of ventilation was in the OR when people were under general anesthesia or if somebody was like completely, like we think they're brain dead. Because that would be horribly mean to do to anybody. We don't even use it now in those areas. But that's our starting point, okay? So the vent can be in a mode where it controls everything. But how awful that would be for a patient. They'd have to be paralyzed and sedated in order to withstand that because that's just awful. So now that we've talked it through, if you look at the slide, it inflates the patient's lungs at a predetermined interval regardless of the patient's inspiratory effort. So I control the respiratory rate regardless of what NIF you do. It gives a preset tidal volume at a preset rate, and the patient cannot trigger a breath. Okay? Now, what you'll see all the time is PRVC. So don't read the words yet, and let's talk it through. Pressure regulated, volume control. So it does still have some control. Okay? So I'm the vent. I keep telling y'all not to read the words, and y'all are all reading the words. Okay? I am the vent, and y'all are all the alveoli. And you say, NIF, and I say, okay, here's a breath. But it's going to be the tidal volume I say it is. Pressure regulated, volume control. The volumes are all the same. So if your patient is on a PRVC of 12,500 with 5 apeat, then I'm going to make sure 12 times a minute that you take a 500 cc breath, volume control. But if you want to breathe over, you can. That's fine with me, but I'm still going to control the volume. So you may breathe 15 times a minute, that's all right, but I'm still going to make sure you get 500 cc's tidal volume because it's a volume control mode. How much pressure support are you going to give? However much you need to get 500 cc's tidal volume. So in PRVC vent settings, you are not going to have a dialed in pressure support number because I give you the pressure support you need for you to take the volume that I demand. So on one breath, you may get 12 of pressure support. On the next breath, you may get 5 of pressure support. On the next breath, you may get 15 of pressure support. It's whatever you need to pull the volume that I demand. PRVC also has, I'm gonna show y'all some ventilator screens in a minute, I think. Oh, I bet she pulled up the wrong PowerPoint. PRVC also, if you look at pressures on the ventilator screen, in PRVC, it goes up when they inhale and it kind of slants down and then it goes down, which is more like what we do. We don't create corners in anything we do. Human created, like inside our body, the natural way of doing things does not make hard corners. When we create a robot that does things or a ventilator that does things, it puts hard corners on things, and those hard corners sometimes can cause damage to soft tissues. So in PRVC, if you look at the waveform of how the vent does, I'll try to find one when I get out of this because I don't have the picture in this version of the PowerPoint, but it goes up and then it kind of angles down and then it deflates, which is much kinder to the alveoli than up, across, down, because that's not how we breathe. We don't go... Right? I mean, that's not how we're all breathing, but that's how a ventilator breathes, but not in PRVC. It's very kind to the lungs, and that's why we never use control anymore, because PRVC is much nicer to our lungs. So now that we've talked about it, the ventilator delivers a breath when the patient exerts NIF. You can decide if you want to breathe. That's fine. But I'm going to give you the same tidal volume every time you breathe. Whether you start it or I do it, you're going to get the same tidal volume every time. If the client doesn't trigger a breath, I'm going to maintain a minimum rate. So if I'm on a PRVC of 12, you're guaranteed to get 12 breaths a minute at a dialed-in tidal volume. If you want to breathe over, more power to you, you're still going to get the same tidal volume because it's a volume control setting. Clear as mud? Then there's SIMV, synchronized intermittent mandatory ventilation. So let's break it down. Mandatory ventilation, you have to breathe. I'm going to make sure you breathe. Synchronized, I'm going to synchronize my breaths with yours, and intermittent, I can kind of come and go, okay? So if I'm the vent, and y'all are the alveoli, and we're on SIMV, when you NIF, I say, okay, here you go. If I'm on an SIMV of 12, I'm going to synchronize with your NIF, and I'm going to give you 12 breaths a minute that have a dialed-in tidal volume of 500 cc's, if that's what it's set on. If you want to breathe over, that's fine. Breathe whatever you want to. Because I am intermittent. I'm 12 times a minute synchronizing with your rhythm to give you the dialed in tidal volume for those breaths. But if you choose to breathe over, it's whatever you want. So what you'll see, let's think about that 80-year-old lady that had all those problems and now had her gallbladder out. 12 times a minute, you're gonna see her go. And then between those breaths, you're gonna say. the good thing is, if we're trying to wean a patient and they're on SIMV, I can see what their spontaneous tidal volume is. Because I'm a little dizzy, I'm sorry. Because on their spontaneous breaths, I can see how much they're pulling. And I may say, for spontaneous tidal volume, it's only 125. But we're not ready to pull a tube on somebody who's only breathing 125 cc's per breath, right? Whereas on PRVC, I don't have any idea what their spontaneous tidal volume is. Because they have to take the same volume every time. Because it's a volume control setting. The downfall to SIMV is that if you have somebody who's weak, like that 80-year-old woman, their respiratory rate will get faster and faster and faster because those breaths between the vent breaths will get smaller and smaller and smaller. So if we have somebody on SIMV who's getting out of control, it's like a snowball running downhill, but the respiratory rate was 24, now it's 30, now I'm 36, and they put them over on PRVC, when we make them start taking big breaths every time, they quit breathing so much. Because they don't need to breathe as often, because they're getting tidal volume when they breathe. But if we have somebody who is healthy or breathing fine, then they may do fine on this IMV, and I can see what their spontaneous tidal volume is. Or they may use a combination of both. But that's the difference between them. So on SIMV, the patient can breathe spontaneously between the breaths. We're going to give a number of breaths per minute, regardless of whether you initiate a breath or not. If you're brain dead and I have you on SIMV of 12, you're going to get 12 breaths a minute at 500 cc's if that's what I have dialed in. You may never breathe over. The vent breaths have a preset tidal volume. The patient breaths, whatever they want. It's whatever they pull. They're still going to get pressure support and PEEP on every one of them. And it's going to be a dialed in amount. So your vent settings might look like SIMV 12. 500, 12, 5. Because that would be an SIMV with a rate of 12, 500 cc tidal volume, pressure support of 12, PEEP of 5. So when you NIF, if it's a vent breath, if it's one of the 12, when you NIF, I'm going to say, here's 12 of pressure support, and by golly, you're pulling 500 cc's because I'm not stopping until you take it. And then when you exhale, I'll say, okay, exhale against this 5. And then you do another breath, but I'm not ready yet. And I say, okay, whatever you want, but I'm still going to give you 12 pressure support. You're still going to get that every time, but I'm not going to control how much volume you take. And you exhale and say, okay, exhale against 5. And now it's time for another breath, and we'll say, okay, here's 12 of pressure support, and you're going to pull 500 cc's because I said so. So it's intermittent. Does that make sense? As opposed to PRVC, which is the same every time.
Is it the volume that's different? So like
the whether or not I declare the tidal volume is intermittent based on whether it's one of my breaths or your breath. And you may also pull, you may NIF, but I say it's time for one of my breaths, so I'm giving you 500 cc's. Yes, ma'am.
Regardless of the tidal,
can you pull your mask down so I can hear you, and then you can put it right back up. She said with SIMV, the tidal volume will be preset but intermittent. Correct. The tidal volume is preset, and on the vent breaths, it's going to be set at that. On your initiated breaths, you can pull whatever you want to. But I'm still going to give you pressure support and PEEP on every breath. As with the PRVC, her question was, is you're right, on PRVC, if my tidal volume is set at 500, every time we breathe, it's 500 because it's volume control. I'm in control of the volume. I don't care who started the breath. You're going to get 500 cc's every time.
And then the SIMV, it's like a set rate that
you're going to
deliver 500, but I can
breathe whatever I want. Right. She said with SIMV, it's a set rate that you're going to get 500 this many times a minute. But then if I breathe above that, it's whatever I want. That's exactly right. Then we have pressure support. Now, this is where it gets confused again, because like respiratory rate, pressure support means two different things. You have pressure support here. Let me help you take this big deep breath, which is a setting on the ventilator. But then you also have a mode of pressure support, which is this. I'm the ventilator. I'm here and ready. I'm going to tell you how much oxygen you get, and I'm going to give you pressure support and PEEP, but that's it. You have to NIF to get a breath. You NIF, I say, okay, here, let me help you take this big deep breath. You go to exhale, exhale against my PEEP. But if you only want to breathe 4 times a minute, all right. If you want to breathe 40 times a minute, all right. pull 150 on one breath and 400 on the next? All right. All I care about is pressure support and feet. You totally determine the volume and the rate. Now, for safety reasons, we have a backup vent mode in place on all of our ventilators that are in clinical now, that if your respirations fall below a certain number, like below 4 maybe, it's going to flip over into a PRVC or an SIMV mode. And it will alarm ding, 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 to let the nurse and the respiratory therapist know, hey, I'm in backup mode because this patient was not breathing like they should be. So it has a rescue mode programmed underneath it, but in pressure support, it's all you. I just say, here, let me help you take that big, deep breath and exhale against this. So really what I've done is I've given you pressure support to overcome all this air resistance you have trying to breathe through this ET tube and 6 feet of tubing that's going to the ventilator. And then I'm giving you peak to give you back what you would have with your epiglottis that I've taken from you because you have a tube stuck in your throat. Right? Or your trach that is below your epiglottis. Either way, we've lost your peak. Right? So you'll hear the nurses say they're doing all the breathing on their own. They're doing all the work. And they are. And this is the last mode that we use before we extubate somebody. Because we want to see how they can do breathing on their own. Can they maintain adequate tidal volumes? Can they maintain a respiratory rate? Are they oxygenating okay? So those are the normal ones. We're going to talk about a few little odd ducks out there. There's also something called high-frequency jet ventilation. We do not do this at Willis-Knighton. They do it over at Ostrich LSU, or they used to, like I heard they did, because they'll use it for patients that have trauma. Like they're trauma patients, if they come in with all these crushing chest injuries and a crushing throat injury, and they've got leaks all in their trachea, they can put a much smaller catheter down through the intratracheal tube into the trachea. And instead of giving 12 breaths a minute at 500 cc's, they'll give 120 breaths a minute with like 3 mL per kg as the tidal volume. Because if I go down on the size of the breath, then I have to go up on the frequency to give them enough oxygen. So what that does is it decreases the amount of pressure, which decreases the amount that they're losing through that leak. So they still give a large minute volume, which is the same thing as minute ventilation, without giving them large volumes, which could cause leak or trapping. So we use this when people have leaks in their trachea, which could be from like a fistula that happens because they've been intubated for too long. But what I mostly see it used for, or used to, last time I was over there, was for trauma patients that had some sort of injury and it was leaking. We also can do inverse ratio. An inverse ratio can be PRVC, can be SIMV, can be one of the combo modes. But what it means with inverse ratio is, remember that inspiratory to expiratory ratio, which is normally 1 to 2. I inhale, exhale, exhale, inhale, exhale, exhale. Well, if we're having a hard time oxygenating somebody, one of the things they can do, if we're on 100% oxygen, very aggressive, you know, vent settings, we still can't get them oxygenated like with ARDS. Then they may say, okay, look, let's put them on 1 to 1. Anytime we mess with the ratio, we call it inverse ratio, even though you and I all know in math class, it would not truly be inverse ratio unless it was 2 to 1. But if they're on 1 to 1, we call it inverse ratio because we're like, we've messed with their ratio. So if you can imagine going, it'll make you dizzy after a minute. If you're spending the same amount of time inhaling and exhaling, then we're spending more time with inhalation than we normally do over a minute, which gives us more time for gas exchange. It also increased the pressure in our chest. Okay, trying to make sure it's not an emergency. We're expecting a visit by OVH, and I was really hoping they weren't going to show up while I was here. So far, we're good. Anyway, if we're inhaling more, remember what this looked like. You and I go inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. That's me and you, not on the vent. put me on the vent, and now I'm inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale, right? If I turn it to 1:1, now it's inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale. So I'm spending more time at that higher pressure setting, which can increase the risk of having some barotrauma, which is the trauma that occurs inside the alveoli because of the pressure. It increases the risk of a pneumothorax, which is when one of y'all goes poof because you can't handle the pressure anymore. It's very uncomfortable because it's not how we normally breathe. So we have to sedate these guys pretty heavily. And if we're, especially if they're on true inverse ratio, but if we start messing with the ratio, they're probably going to put them on some sort of continuous paralytic as well. Never give a paralytic without a sedative, okay? Paralytic fixes your vent problems, but it doesn't sedate the patient, and they are very aware of what's going on. Sedation makes them not aware. Now, Ms. Walker used to teach this lecture to me when I was in those chairs, and she said it's like being in a coffin because you can't move, you can't react, but you can see everybody going by and hear everything that's being said and feel everything that's happening to you. But then I heard one of my fellow students explain to a family member, it's like being in a coffin, and so I don't usually use that, but I'll tell you, be careful how you talk to family. You're going to scare them to death. But it's mean. It's very mean. Never paralyze somebody and don't sedate them. Major side effect of inverse ratio is hypotension. So let's bring back hemodynamics, because y'all know how much I love those, okay? We're giving them more time for air to exchange. She said, what are we accomplishing by doing this? We're giving more time for air exchange, so we're increasing their oxygenation. This is not somebody we do on just Joe Blow that rolls in that had surgery or who's on a drug overdose. This is somebody who has ARDS, COVID, something's horribly wrong with their lungs, and we need to give them more time for gas exchange. These are sick people, not everybody. So major side effect is hypotension. So this is going to be hard. Y'all hang with me, okay? You could just memorize that side effect is hypotension. If that's what you want to do, you can. But I like to understand why things happen. So inverse ratio. If we think about this again, what have we done to the mean pressure in our chest if we've gone inverse ratio? Is it going up or down? It's gone up because we're spending more time in inhalation, right? So if the pressure in my chest has increased, then the blood that's trying to get from my toes back up into the left side, right side of my heart, is it easier or harder for it to get up there if the pressure's higher? It's harder. So what has happened to the preload of my heart? It's gone up or down?
Down.
Down. If my preload decreases, what happens to my cardiac output?
Decreases.
It goes down because I can't pump forward what I'm not getting. So what happens to my blood pressure?
It drops.
It goes down. So let's do that again. If I have altered my inspiratory to expiratory ratio to where I'm spending more time in inhalation, which is a higher pressure on the positive pressure ventilator, then the mean pressure in my chest has gone up or down?
Up.
Very good. If the pressure in my chest is higher, then the blood trying to come from my toes upstream is having an easier or harder time?
Harder.
So the preload to the right side of my heart has
decreased.
If my preload has decreased, what's happened to my stroke volume?
Decreased.
If my stroke volume decreases, what's happened to my cardiac output?
Decreases.
So I get hypotensive. Because I can't pump forward what I'm not getting. So we have some people that will try inverse ratio, their blood pressure will go down, we'll go, ooh, we can't do that because they can't tolerate it. Or maybe we need to go in slower, smaller pieces. We also have the ability to do what's called bi-level ventilation. I'm not going to get way far off into this. And if Ms. Akins is listening, please don't write a test question on bi-level ventilation. I'm only telling you about this. Y'all text whoever's writing the test and say, she said we would not be tested on bi-level ventilation. I'm only telling you about it in case you run across somebody in clinical with it. And what it is two simultaneous vent modes running at the same time. It's like two modes of SI and V running at the same time. And it gives you one level of peak if you initiated the breath and a different level of peak if the vent gave the breath. They use it for patients with very sick lungs to try to reduce the amount of peak that we're giving a patient to reduce the amount of baritone they're having. So I do know we use this on some really sick people. They use it over ostrophil issue as well. I see Ms. Aikens up there, so she knows not to write a test question about it. But just know that that's what's happening to try to protect the lungs from having too much barotrauma.
There will be no test questions on bilevel or on the iron lung.
Okay. We also have BiPAP. Now, BiPAP, y'all learned about in second level, but we're going back to talk about it again because y'all are going to realize y'all been learning some of this stuff in second level. You just didn't realize it, okay? BiPAP is non-invasive. This is somebody who doesn't have a trach, doesn't have a tube down their throat. They have a mask on. We're trying to keep them off the ventilator. So listen to what BiPAP is. BiPAP, biphasic positive airway pressure. So what it does is it has two levels. Like the order will say BiPAP 100%, 12 over 6. So what it does is it says, oh, you're inhaling? Here, let me help you take this big deep breath at 12. Oh, you're exhaling now? Breathe out again at 6. What does that sound like? Pressure support and peak. Exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. Non-invasive. So we call it IPAP, inspiratory positive airway pressure, and EPAP, expiratory positive airway pressure. But really, IPAP? It's pressure support, and EPAP is peak. We just call them by different names depending on whether you have a tube stuck in your throat or not. Same thing. That is why when COVID hit hard and we were scrambling every day trying to say, how many people do we have in the hospital? How many people do we have on the ventilator? How many ventilators do we have available? Do we need to shift them around the health system to make sure we have enough? It's the only time in my career that we've ever worried that we were going to have a patient come into the ER that we were not going to have an available ventilator to put them on. And you want to talk about sick feeling in your stomach? That is something you never want to have to tell a family. You are right. They need to be put on the breathing machine, but we don't have any more. I mean, it was awful. We even have some ventilators at Willis-Knighton. That's one ventilator that you can put tubing out to 5 patients on one vent so they can share the ventilator that we had set up and ready because we were that close. But we were able to use some of our BiPAP machines to hook to patients who had ET tubes in to give them, to use as a mechanical ventilator. Why? Because BiPAP and a pressure support mode on the vent are exactly the same thing. It's just BiPAP if it's not invasive and pressure support mode if it's invasive. Does that make sense? So we were able to use some of those in ICUs for patients who were getting better, who weren't quite ready to extubate yet, but we still need to give some support. We could use our BiPAP machines, and we rigged it up to their tube to use that as a ventilator. Now, if they got into trouble and needed to be put back on a rate, they would have to get a vent back. But some of our BiPAP machines, though, they actually can have a rate dialed in, too. And those, we could just keep them right on that same machine and use that as a ventilator, even though really it was a BiPAP machine. We got very ingenious in the midst of all this to try to come up with ways to use the resources we have. We never did get to our health system to the point we tell people no, but there were places in our state that did. Down south, there were some places where they ran out of ventilators and didn't have any. CPAP, y'all know what that is. We put that on people who have sleep apnea to try to keep all that soft tissue pushed apart so that they have a good airway, keeps them from desatin during the night and waking up, makes them more rested. So CPAP is just a continuous pressure that's there all the time, whether you inhale or exhale, and you exhale against it to keep your soft tissues open. What's that? Peep. It's the same thing. And if you hear the nurses, they'll slip up because they'll say, they have CPAP order, I think, yeah, they have 5 a peep. But really it's 5 a CPAP, but we all know it's really the same thing. It's just that if you're intubated, we call it PEEP, and if you're not, we call it CPAP. Same thing. And look how much we give them. 1 to 5. How much PEEP do we normally have people on the vent? 3 to 5. It's the same thing. So PEEP and pressure support are both positive pressure. We know that that can do something. It causes decreased cardiac output, right? Because we decrease preload because the pressure in our chest is higher. It increases your intracranial pressure, which makes sense.
Your CSF drains from your head down your neck into your chest. If I raise the pressure in my chest, what am I doing to the pressure in my head? It's going up. What am I doing to the pressure in my abdomen? It's going up. So if I have a patient that has a brain trauma and I'm trying to control their ICP, you may walk in and look at their vent settings and go, they're on zero PEEP. That's weird. If you go in and your patient has zero PEEP ordered on their vent, you need to start digging, figuring out why, because that's not normal. We all have 3 to 5 of PEEP. We give them 3 to 5 of PEEP to overcome the fact that we've blocked off their epiglottis. But there are some patients they'll put on zero PEEP because of what the effects of PEEP are. If my ICP is out of control or I'm worried about it, they may dial them into zero PEEP because we're breathing okay, but I can't take the chance of increasing my ICP. Or if you have a patient who has abdominal compartment syndrome, they may put them on zero PEEP to keep from making the pressure in their belly go higher. Or if you have somebody that's on 4 pressors to try to keep their pressure up because their heart's so weak, they may have them on zero PEEP because when they intubated and put them on the vent, because we shifted the curve from this to this, that pressure change may have been enough to knock out their cardiac output because I've decreased their preload. Maybe not without even changing their I to E ratio, but just because I put them on positive pressure ventilation because I changed the pressure in their chest by doing that. So if you have a patient with zero PEEP, I'm not saying it's wrong. We use it. We use zero PEEP, but you need to figure out why, because it's not normal. We don't default to that. We default to 5. That's our default, unless there's a reason to change it. And you're going to find people that are on 12 of PEEP. They're sick. And we're very worried about a pneumothorax if they're on that much PEEP. But you'll see it. Complications of positive pressure ventilation, they can get a pneumothorax. They can wind up with sub-Q emphysema. We had a patient one time that had a trachea leak. I don't remember what from. I don't remember if he had cancer. I can't remember. But he was intubated. He had this tracheal leak. And by 7 a.m. every morning, he was puffed up like a toad frog. You couldn't open his eyes to check his pupils. His chin was touching his chest. Because of that leak, air was leaking out into his sub-Q tissue. And you could do like this, and it felt like a bowl of Rice Krispies underneath his skin. So one of our surgeons would come in every morning and scrub him down with betadine, because this was before CHG was popular, and get angiocasts like I'm starting an IV and stick about 6 of them in him, and he would go and deflate because the air would come out. And he would look better, and then by 7 a.m. the next morning, he'd be all blown up again. He had an infection, and we were trying to treat the infection so that he could go to surgery to have it repaired. And that's why they were doing that. It also causes atelectasis if you're on the vent. Cardiovascular impairment, we talked about that. People on the vent tend to wind up with GI bleeds and with ileuses. And the only thing we can really connect with that is it's probably because they're not up moving around like you and I are. And so things don't work well like they're supposed to. And then fluid and electrolyte imbalances. And some of those we correct with the vent. If the patient has gotten acidotic, it may be because of a respiratory cause, it may be because of a metabolic cause, but we can use the ventilator to help treat that short term. They can have tracheal trauma, wind up with a fistula, especially if they're intubated too long. It can cause stenosis. They can wind up with lesions on their mucosa from that plastic hard tube being against their pink, moist skin. They can get an infection, oxygen toxicity, and then sinusitis and nasal injury for your nasopharyngeal and nasotracheal tube intubations, not necessarily for oropharyngeal. So if you get a patient that's on the vent, when you go in to assess them, you're going to listen to breath sounds, you're going to suction them, then you're going to listen to breath sounds again. You're going to check your cuff and squeeze to see if it pops back out. You're going to check your tube to make sure where it is at the lip. You're going to look at your ventilator settings, and then you're going to make sure that that's what's ordered. You're not going to document the orders as your ventilator settings. You're going to look at your vent to see what the settings are. Because some intensivists may have come around and tweaked the vent and hadn't written an order yet, and then you're going to be documenting the patients on something that they're not. So you look at your ventilator to get your settings. And then you're going to look for symptoms of ventilator-associated pneumonia. Are they running a fever? Do they suddenly have green, thick secretions that's new? count? Is their chest x-ray cloudy today and it hasn't been? The ventilator also has alarms that are built in. And we're going to talk about some of these. The high pressure alarm, I want y'all to think about, like, if you have a water hose at home. If you get your water hose and the water's running and it's just trickling out the end of it and I slightly kink off the water hose, what happens to that water? It starts shooting across the yard, right? We all learned as kids that we can put our thumb partially over the end of the water hose and make it come out and go a lot further. So if you have a high pressure alarm, something has happened that's making the pressure in the system be too high. It can be because the tubing is kinked. There's water in the tubing that's obstructing flow, so that's no different than you putting your finger over the end of the water hose. The patient is anxious, fighting against the ventilator, coughing, biting. They need to be suctioned, and their secretions. Or while you're suctioning, it's going to alarm because you make them cough, and that makes the high pressure alarm trigger. So when you're thinking about your alarms, keep in mind pressure versus volume. This is a high pressure alarm. Also, that ET tube that we looked at a while ago, if you look on this picture, there's your cuff on your ET tube. This comes down, and the big opening on the ET tube is at the end here. And sometimes it can get up against the wall of the trachea, and then it kind of plugs it off there. Now, there's a backup place here. There's a little hole on the side of it. They do that in case there's a lot of secretions or it gets positioned against the side of the trachea that you didn't lose your airway. But this hole is a lot smaller than this one. So it's going to make your high pressure alarm go off because it's like putting your thumb over the end of the water hose. If the patient's having a bronchospasm so that their trachea is actually constricting, that's going to make the pressure go up. If they have a tension pneumothorax, that would be life-threatening. We certainly need to pick up on that. If the ET tip's down the right main stem, or it can be either, but if it went down into one side of the lungs, if you're given two lungs worth of oxygen down to one lung, well, you're going to have a high pressure alarm going off because you're stretching the lung too much. Or if you have somebody who has decreased lung compliance. So the lung compliance is the stretch of the lung. So if they have some sort of disease that causes their lungs to get stiff, then your high pressure alarm will start going off, like ARDS, COVID, pulmonary fibrosis. You're also going to have a low exhaled volume alarm. Now, this is volume, not pressure. So what's going to make the vent go, wait a minute, I gave you 500 cc's and you gave me back 200. Hey, I need somebody to know about this. It could be because they've come disconnected from the vent and they blew 500 cc's into the room. I mean, the room will take it, right? But the room's not going to give it anything back. It's going to be like, whoa, I didn't get my breath back. It could be because that cuff is deflated and it's going out around the tube. It could be because the tube itself has a crack in it because they've bent it. Low pressure alarm, this isn't volume, but these two will sound simultaneously a lot. Because if you're losing volume, you're probably also losing pressure. So if you have a leak in the system, they've come disconnected from the vent, the ET tube's leaking, or there's some sort of power interruption, it will cause that. You also have an apnea alarm. This is what I was talking about in the pressure support mode. If their respiratory rate falls low enough that they're like, yeah, no, that's not enough. If they wait too long between breaths, then it will alarm and say, hey, apnea, apnea, and it may flip over to another mode. If we're weaning a patient off the ventilator, these are our criteria. If we're saying we're going to extubate them off the vent, if we're going to pull the tube, we're going to extubate them. We want their FiO2 to be less than 50%. If they're on more than 50% oxygen, we're not going to want to extubate because the only devices we have, well, and I say that until COVID happened. But for the general population, they're going to want them to be on 50% or less. Now, we had some COVID patients that were doing fine, but they just required lots of O2, and they did wind up extubating them and putting them on high flow. Because we know that vent times lead to increased mortality in COVID patients. That's what we've learned about COVID since it started. It's been really interesting to watch because the science has changed quickly with COVID because it was a novel disease. It was new. In the very beginning for COVID, it was, if you get above 4 liters nasal cannula, intubate. Like, we didn't do anything else. We didn't BiPAP, CPAP, high flow. We didn't do any of that. Part of the reason why is because BiPAP, CPAP, high flow all cause aerosols to be created, and we knew the disease was spread that way, and nobody in the United States had enough PPE to be doing that. So to save our staff, we intubated early. That wasn't bad. It wasn't wrong. It didn't hurt anybody that we knew of. But then as we started studying COVID as it went forward, we realized that the more days you're on the vent, your mortality increased greatly.
Right.
So now the way that we treat COVID is keep them off the vent as long as possible and get them off as soon as possible, because vent days is one of the primary indicators of mortality. So it's been in less than a year, our way of treating the disease has changed totally. But if we're not talking about COVID, we want them on less than 50% oxygen. We want their PEEP to be 5 or less. Why? Because we have 5, right? We have 3 to 5 walking around. If they're requiring 10 a PEEP, well, they don't have that. So we're going to be in trouble when we pull the 2. We want their respiratory rate to be less than 30 and a minute ventilation less than 10. Now, your minute ventilation is your tidal volume times your respiratory rate. If they're having to move more than 10 liters of air a minute, they're having to work too hard. And they may be able to do that for a bit, but they're going to tire out and we're going to wind up reintubating. They should have a spontaneous tidal volume of 4 to 5 mils per kg. What mode would we not know that on? ERVC, because it's volume control. I don't have any idea what their spontaneous tidal volume is. But we normally have everybody on pressure support before we extubate anyway, so we would certainly know what spontaneous tidal volume is. We want a PaO2 of greater than 60 on an FiO2 of less than 50. So we're giving them 50% or less of oxygen, but on their ABG, their PO2 is 60 or better. We want a PaCO2 that's normal for the patient, because if we say it has to be normal, we're going to kill COPD patients trying to get a normal CO2. Normal for them. And they may do something called TPS trials. So if they're not sure, and they want to make sure that the patient's okay before they pull a tube out, what they'll do is they'll disconnect all the vent, and they'll just put, they call it a TPS because it's corrugated tubing that's shaped like this. They'll connect that onto the ET tube. Sorry, they can do it to trachs too. We do it on trachs a lot. But they can put it on the ET tube, and it's humidified oxygen, and they say, go for it, big boy. And we just let them breathe on their own. And if you can breathe okay, just getting humidified oxygen with that long, skinny ET tube in your mouth, that's kind of like her sucking on that sonic straw, then you're going to be fine when we pull that tube out. Because it's harder in a TP straw than it is once we pull the tube out, because we get rid of all that length and skinny tube, right? They may also, too, do something called a leak test, and I don't have that on there, but if they're worried about swelling for somebody who either had angioedema, had an anaphylactic reaction, has been on the vent a long time, and they're worried about airway swelling, they'll get respiratory therapy to do a leak test, and what they mean by that is they'll go in, leave all the securement devices in place, deflate that 10cc balloon, and see if they develop an air leak around their tube. An air leak is good if we're doing it on purpose. If I deflate that balloon and they don't leak any air around their tube, that means their airway is swollen to the point that it's almost the same size as the tube. That's bad. So they'll tell them we did an air leak. They didn't have one. They'll give them steroids and we'll try again the next day. And most times the next day they'll have an air leak. They'll go ahead and pull the tube. Okay, that means I'm done, and now we'll see if y'all learned anything, okay? So do not call your answers out loud. Alexandria, this one's going to be for you. Oops, I skipped it. Which client should have little or no PEEP? So y'all can talk to a neighbor, but don't call it out loud. And when Alexandria thinks they have an answer, they're going to let us know what they think of it.
What's going on?
Yeah. And y'all can see this is a select all little plot. Yeah. Somebody's having a snack. It's making me hungry. I can hear them crinkling it. I'm not judging you, I'm just jealous. I'm sorry.
Okay, do y'all know yet?
Yeah.
God is truth. Okay, and it said C, clients suffering from head trauma, right?
Okay, so they like C. Let's talk about that one first. If we have a patient who has head trauma from a motor vehicle crash, and we put them on P, what's going to happen to their ICP? It's going to go up. So do y'all agree with Alexandria that we should be have little or no peak on that patient?
Right.
Absolutely. Y'all are doing great so far, Alexandria. Anybody else?
I think B.
Okay, so let's talk about B. We have a patient who had surgery. They got anesthesia, and now their gut hasn't woken up quickly enough. Is pressure going to affect that?
Okay.
No. We need the anesthesia to wear off. We need to get them moving as soon as possible. The B could have PEEP and it would be fine. Now, I think what probably threw you is that we talked about abdominal compartment syndrome, but that's very different than a paralytic illness.
What was you thinking about?
Okay.
Anybody else?
What? Anything else? Go back to A.
I hear y'all talking about A. Okay, let's say that y'all chose A. A's good. Let's go with A. So we have A who's in septic shock. So shock means I don't have enough blood pressure, but you don't know why. It's at septic shock. What it, septic shock means, we have an infection of something. My body is not compensating. My vessels have gotten all floppy and big, and I am on levofed, dopamine, and epinephrine to support my cardiac output because of the shock state that I'm in. What's going to happen when we hook them up to a vent with 10 apeep or 5 apeep?
Okay.
It's going to do what to their preload?
Decrease,
which is going to do what to their stroke volume? Which is going to do what to their cardiac output? Which is going to do what to their blood pressure?
Oh, my goodness.
Decrease. You are so smart, Alexandra. You're exactly right. But that I'm not saying that you're never going to see a patient on three pressors on PEEP. But what I am saying is that that patient, we're going to have to be very careful about connecting to PEEP because we have three medicines going to support their blood pressure, and we know an increased pressure is going to be a whammy to that. So you're absolutely right that A and C are the correct answers. We've already discussed why B is not. D is a patient who's getting nitro. Nitro is for what? Hypertension. So if anything, a little PEEP might help them out, right? Now, is it possible? I doubt it. But is it possible, theoretically, that we hook them to PEEP and we might have to go down on their nitro a little bit? I guess, theoretically. I can't say I've ever seen that happen. But we certainly are not going to say they can't have any. Good job, Alexandria. That's hard. Okay, just let y'all fly. So good job. Y'all are definitely listening. Okay, Natchitoches.
So we're probably going to have low
mood. Your patient volume. Has a respiratory rate of 6.
So, I don't know. I'm what just alarm?
Line alarm on the vent. Don't call it out. Y'all can talk to your neighbor, but don't call it out. This is Natchitoches' question.
So if they're not breathing, they're going to have low minute volume, right? Because they're not having as many breaths. I missed the alarm stuff.
Yeah,
so.
Minute volume is respiratory rate times whatever.
So the consensus here is B, low minute volume.
Well, the consensus is absolutely correct. Good job, Natchitoches. High pressure alarm has to do with pressures. They don't have anything to do with volume. Low pressure alarm, nothing to do with volume. Low minute volume alarm, remember your minute volume is respiratory rate times tidal volume. And if my respiratory rate has dropped, then our minute volume has dropped. And so we may have a low minute volume alarm.
That select all apply was there to throw us.
Low pressure alarm does kind of go hand in hand with volume alarms if it's caused by a loss of volume. Like there's a leak in the system, there's a hole in the tube, but just because my respiratory rate drops, it didn't have anything to do with pressure. But they do typically go hand in hand. Okay, Shreveport. There's condensation in the loops of the tubing, like the vent tubing going between the patient's ET tube and the vent. What do y'all think is going to happen?
A.
A. They think I gave them the easiest question. They think it's a high pressure alarm, and they are absolutely right. This is just like putting your thumb over the end of the water hose. If I make the diameter of the tube pressure go up. They did that one too quickly. They're getting the next one too. What if the patient has a mucus plug? It's the same question, right? Doesn't matter if it's condensation or a mucus plug. It's blocking part of the flow of the vent. It's going to make the pressure go up. You're absolutely right. Alexandria, we're back to you.
C.
Oh, wow. I haven't even read the thing.
We got that one.
So they say C, and they are absolutely correct. What if I made this a select all that apply?
B.
Then
A and B.
B.
The main select all apply would be C and
B.
I said B.
That is correct, C and B. The first thing that's going to alarm is low pressure, because low pressure is going to happen immediately when you disconnect. If you take a long time to get in there, because we're also losing volume, you're going to wind up with a low minute volume also. But the low pressure is by far going to be the first one. Natchitoches?
C. Yeah, that's C.
Y'all have lots of words. I'll give y'all a minute.
I feel like asymmetrical movement would be very bad there. But, I mean...
Did everybody agree?
No.
Okay.
I haven't even heard it, so...
Yeah.
That's a beautiful in place question. What do you have?
C.
C. That's absolutely correct. What do you think is wrong with that patient in C?
The tube's moved. Like one side is not, is like
they're
filled with liquid
the
or something.
Too far down,
the
and maybe they picked
not in the
up
right
on asymmetrical chest movement because it's in one side or the other. That could be it. What else could it be?
The lung side.
A tension pneumothorax or a pneumothorax, either which is good, right? It is so important with positive pressure ventilation that my preceptor, when I was a brand new nurse many years ago, maybe before you were born, taught us that on every ventilated patient we ever took care of, we were charting longhand on paper at the time, that I had to write respirations, even and unlabored, with symmetrical chest expansion and trachea midline. Every chart I opened had that sentence in it if they were on the vent, if it was true. Because what that was saying to any attorney that read my charting is, they're not in distress, they don't have a pneumothorax, we're good, right? All right, if y'all have any questions, please, please, please give me a call. Y'all still have my cell phone number, I hope, but I'm going to give it to you again in case anybody needs it. It's 318-470-5178. If you have a question about the material, if you need to text message me, I FaceTimed the study group last semester, or the first half of the semester, that was having a vent crisis the night before the test. I am here to help you any way I can. If any of you want a job, please feel free to give me a text message. I am here to help you any way I can. Do not feel guilty for reaching out to me, okay? Y'all have a great night today. Enjoy.
Thank you, Delisa. I appreciate you.
25 minutes back.
Thank you.
You're welcome.